Blog Talk Radio.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started to hum. Still, it's a real good bet, the best is yet to come. The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? You think you've seen the sun, but you ain't seen it shine. Wait till the warm-up's underway. Wait till our lips have met. Wait till you see that sunshine day. You ain't seen nothing yet. The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? The best is yet to come. Come the day you're mine. Come the day you're mine, I'm gonna teach you to fly. We've only tasted the wine. We're gonna drain the cup dry. Wait till your charms are ripe for these arms to surround. You think you've flown before, but you ain't left the ground. Here, the best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? The best is yet to come, come the day you're mine. Oh, of a tree of life, I just picked me a plum.
Yes, it's Friday, August the 23rd, 2013. And this is The Last Word. My name is Michael Lawson. I'm here with Thomas Fortenberry. Birthday boy, Fortenberry.
Thank you, sir.
He's only 12 years old, so, you know, you don't have to worry about him. He doesn't drink.
But I'm going on 13.
He doesn't do any of those things because he's just a young sir. My grandson thinks he's Thomas the Train.
The tank engine.
The tank engine, yes. But we have a lot of things going on today. We got a lot of major guests going in. But this is, getting back to some serious points, this is the 50th birthday.
Birthday?
The 50th anniversary.
We have birthdays on the mind.
I got birthdays on the mind. The 50th anniversary. Oh, man, I can't believe that. I was... I just graduated from high school, got my first year of college, and I remember this because we took off that day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the 50th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech.
Dr. Martin Luther King.
Mm. And we're going to hear that later, but I just want to say a few things about it. And I Have a Dream.
One thing I was going to say, it couldn't have been. I mean, it's very bittersweet, but the fact that this is the 50th year couldn't have fallen at a better time.
A better time.
Absolutely. To bring attention to these
this
yahoos
the
that we got.
Big time. And the I Have a Dream speech was a public speech delivered by an American activist, Martin Luther King Jr., on August 28, 1963. And which he called for an end to racism in the United States. Delivered by over 250,000 civil rights supporters and from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. And they did not know, they were just hoping they were going to get a couple of tens of thousands.
Yep.
and during this March on Washington, and it was for jobs and freedom. The speech was a defining moment of the American Civil Rights Movement, beginning with a reference to the Emancipation Proclamation, which freed millions of slaves in 1863.
We have to acknowledge is from Abraham Lincoln.
That's right. King examines that. 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. At the end of the speech, King departed from his prepared text and partially improvised on a theme of I Have a Dream, which was possibly prompted by Mahalia Jackson's cry, "Tell them about the dream, Martin." In this part of the speech, which most excited the listeners and has now become the most famous, King describes his dreams of freedom and equality arising from a land of slavery and hatred. The speech was ranked as the top American speech of the 20th century by 1999 poll of scholars of public address.
That's a hefty lift. not just like the best speech of the year, the best speech of civil rights. No, the best speech of the entire 20th
century.
And
so,
by the way,
so there's no other speech because we're in the 21st century.
Yeah. By the way, a few other things occurred during the 20th century.
Like,
so it wasn't like he had no competition.
This is the best speech. Not the we're gonna fight him in the air, on the sea, on the land by Winston Churchill?
No.
Not the Kennedy address? No. This speech. And for your listening pleasure, here is.
I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King. I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro has still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. And so we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summit of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content, we'll have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But that is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must fail to conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protests to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is freedom. We cannot walk alone. As we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of all the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our body is heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the city. We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote, and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, no, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution.
Yes.
And staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream.
Yes.
It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream.
Yes.
I have a dream that one day,
yes,
this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
Yeah.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification,
yeah,
One day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. And every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, tears of thee."
Yes.
Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing.
Oh, yes.
Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride.
Yes.
From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring.
Yes.
From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Right now, we have the president of the NAACP in Charlotte, North Carolina, Reverend Kojo Nantumbu. Is that?
Nantumbu.
Okay.
Nantumbu, yes, sir.
Nantumbu.
How you doing, Michael? How's it going, man?
I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. Doing much better. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. That's very chilling. It's always a chilling experience to hear that speech. It's so powerful. It's so very, very illustrative, but most of all, it's very descriptive of this country, and it's always indicative of the kind of feeling, the kind of desire, the kind of hope that we have in this country. Those of us who would hope for this country to be a better country, those of us would hope that things would change, like racial profiling and racial injustice, and things would change, like our children and all of us continuously being judged by the color of our skin and by the neighborhoods we live in and by the income that we make, as opposed to being judged by the content of our character. And how, in spite of the fact that he's been gone now over 50 years, how that we still have more poor people today than we had when Martin Luther King was killed, and that actually wages in this country have not increased in terms of medium income since Dr. King was killed, and how we have more people in prison now since Dr. King was killed, especially the fact that we have about four times as more African Americans in prison than the time that he was killed. So it's a very chilling, it's a very, very hopeful and very, very spiritual-driven speech that makes you want to fight for a better day, makes you want to fight for a better society, a better for humanity, and at the same time it makes you realize that your fight is deeper, it's a much harder fight than it was before, and it is much more of an technological fight as it is an intellectual fight. But more than anything, today it's more spiritual than it was then, when it says that we deal with principalities and wickedness in high places, and it was then, but it was a lot of the lower, citizens' council and the average elected official and people down on the lower end who was giving more trouble. But now it's from the very highest ends of Congress and the Senate that we have this kind of evil being permeated throughout the country through groups like ALEC and the Koch brothers and Art Pope and such, you know, and Civitas and groups who have just come together. And they are more, as they say, they're more of a hyperdrone. They're like racism and evil and division on crack, you know, on steroids, as has been said. So Dr. King was a great man. I still think we haven't had a leader, a hero as great as him in this last two millennium. He made great sacrifices. He was a great orator, a great spirit, very intelligent and wise man. And so we're going to try to pay homage to Dr. King on next Wednesday, the 28th, the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, though we do have people going to Washington tonight, leaving tonight at 12 o'clock for Mayfield Memorial on our bus, and they'll be there tomorrow in Washington, D.C., celebrating. The actual anniversary is August 28th, so on next Wednesday, August the 28th, in Marshall Park, we'll be having a commemoration and a celebration, but at the same time, we'll be engaging in protests of the fact that after 50 years, very little has changed. We've made some gains, yes, we've made some strides, but you should have made enough strides that at this point, we should not have to be arguing about the same thing, fighting for, facing the same kind of struggles that we faced during the time of Dr. King and before. And this time, it's even more diabolical because they're using the laws in a more sophisticated and more mendacious manner than they did before. And they're very tricky with it. And they've put some things in place that are almost as if though we may not even be able to overcome them in the next 10 years, maybe, again, without struggling. But God is good. He was good before. And the people won't rest until justice is served. And so we're going to keep fighting. We're asking people to please come out to Marshall Park at 5 o'clock next Wednesday to celebrate with us Dr. William Barber II, the president of the State Conference of Branches of the NAACP, will be there speaking. We also have local speakers who will be talking about voting rights and how it's going to take our ability to vote to get these people out of office. That's why they're trying to suppress the vote. We'll be talking about women's rights. We'll be talking about health and how they try to cut off, or how they've cut off affordable health care so that over 500,000 people are without health care, and how they've cut unemployment. Well, 170,000 people will lose their unemployment, and then they've cut it so low that basically you can't live off it. You couldn't live off it before. How they've cut their budget for education so that we're losing thousands of teachers, and we've lost tens of thousands of seats in Bright Beginnings and Head Start, a program that has been touted all over the world, being the best program ever designed to help low-income and lower minority children get a good start, a good head start, and be on equal terms when they go in school, and how they've expanded the tax base. Even though they've cut taxes, basically for the wealthy and corporations, but they expanded the tax base, which increases the taxes on the poor, and how that over 900,000 people, almost a million people in North Carolina, poor people, will lose their earned income credit because this General Assembly and this governor felt that it was just too much to allow anybody in this state to receive any kind of help. And so we're facing a time right now where we're worse than we were 150 years ago. And though there have been strides made, but in terms of the things that we're going through right now, this government that we have right now, this state government, this state General Assembly is trying to take us back so far that it's almost as if it was a time that before even slavery was, that they're trying to make it so bad. So we're fighting. We're asking everybody to join the fight, asking everybody to join the NAACP, Action North Carolina, Democracy North Carolina, Greenpeace, the Sierra Club, the teachers, the North Carolina Association of Educators right here in Charlotte, and all of us come out and join us as we begin to celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King. But at the same time, we're giving information and trying to raise the consciousness of our community to let them know what is happening in our General Assembly, how these laws impact you and your family and those that are around you, and what can be done to overcome these new laws.
Well,
thank you, Reverend.
Yes, sir. And I want to say that's the end of our show.
Yeah.
And we'll
we covered everything.
Next Friday, because we got nothing else to say.
That was perfect, though, summation of where we're at and what the problem is today.
And you talk about the speech. It is the number one speech of the 20th century, right?
I have no doubt. I have no doubt.
Same poll of scholars and public addresses. The number one speech. Not the invasion of London with during the Blitz.
Yeah. I got you. With Churchill, right.
Yeah, not FDR speech.
AFK.
About
JFK
not JFK's speech. This speech was the number one speech.
Well, I think it's
and those men made some great speeches that addressed the time. They made some speeches that addressed the moment that were very significant and they were apropos for the time. But that particular speech that Dr. Martin Luther King can be made at any age, in any period of time in history, especially in this country, and it speaks to the soul of this country and to the soul of the individuals of this country and what people go through daily in our daily interactions with each other and the various races, the various denominations, the various genders and stuff. He spoke to that, which is the heart of man and the heart of our situation. So it was a timeless speech. It could have been made today, and it would have been very appropriate and accurate if it was made today. So that's why it is such a chilling and such a strong speech.
We've gone full circle.
Yes, we have. We've come full circle.
Full circle in 50
Michael,
years.
We've come full circle.
It's poignant in the fact, though, and it's actually directly correlated. The reason we come full circle, and this goes back to what you said several times, Mike, is that we're in a time now where the ultra-conservatives are literally on the ropes, and they know the tide of time is against them demographically, you know, progressively, intellectually, and this is their last great gasp. And that's why it's so hardcore. That's why they are striking as fiercely as they can at everything, the roots of society, you know, the economic roots, the political roots, so, you know, anything that can...
That's true.
You know, and I think it's really telling that their huge plans, I mean, even like in our state where they were putting us back in the 1860s, literally, they're talking about they may last 10 years. You think about that. That's a fantastic statement. You know, and that tells you just how desperate they are, and that is why the speech still resonates, because they're doing everything they can to undo it, you know, just like they want to undo the great society that FDR set up. You know, they
and that's something. Yeah.
Progress.
Yeah. I mean, and they even said that the great society was a myth, that it didn't work, and during that period of time, there was more upward mobility of whites than it was anybody else. So it obviously worked. Then it increased and enhanced the ability of the whole middle class, and whites were elevated more than blacks during that time. It just allowed the opportunity for blacks to get up. We were able to stand up, but middle class whites were able to move up, you know. So, but they're saying that it didn't even happen. It was a failure. That's the biggest lie, you know. And that's another thing they do. They lie about history. They keep doing revisionist history. They lie about what happened. Lie about what is happening, and they distort stuff so much that most of our people don't even understand that there has been some changes in this country and that there is some good in this country. All they can see is the blind things that they're putting before us.
Right. All you got to do is look at the grapes of wrath Yeah. And you can see
right.
that. The grace
yeah.
of that.
Yeah.
And
that's right.
And what they,
that's right.
And what Thomas Edison said, I'm building the cars so the people who work for me can afford to buy them.
And, afford yeah. the light, and that's right.
Not the uber wealthy,
the
regular
wealthy.
Person.
That's right.
But these people, these art folks, and these other regressive malcontents, as I call them, have now saw the light where, you know what? Hey, we can do this because we can.
That's right. But at the same time, they're jeopardizing the stability of this country because just like Ford said, just like anybody, if you don't pay your people a living wage, if you don't pay them adequate wage so they can get the things that they need, so they can get the things that this country produced, then those who are over those productions, they're not going to have anybody buying the things that they produce eventually, and we're going to suffer. And they can send them overseas all day long, but if the economy overseas is lower than ours, how are they going to afford the things that we're making?
Well, see, here's the problem. They don't care. The guy who is the biggest resort owner in the entire world, and I can't remember his name, we did a show with him last year, he said if they want an increase in salary, the people that work for him, he has like over 5,000 properties. He says, I will go bankrupt, I'll sell it, I'll give up, I'll walk
just shut it down.
I'll shut it down, and I'll go off to the Bahamas and live like a king. That is their attitude. They
yeah.
don't care because they have theirs.
Yeah, and that's all it is.
They don't care. They may not care, but what has to happen is the masses of the people, those who are working, got to get enough guts and enough intelligence and enough coordination and cooperation with each other to go ahead and say, okay, we'll try it. And just say, okay, we just won't work. Go ahead and go to the Bahamas. We'll find something else to do because that's not the only hotel in the world. It's not the only business in the world. And none of them not paying that much money anyway. So if they work somewhere else, it won't kill them. If they all decide to leave at one time to go to that place, let's see what he say when his stock falls and all that. Yeah, he may have enough money, but believe me, when he has to start paying off stockholders and dividends, he won't have all that money.
Yeah.
We have a call in here. Let's see who's calling. Hello, caller. Who are you? Who's that?
Hi, this is Justice Sherry Beasley.
Hello.
Hey, Justice Beasley, how you doing? It's good to hear your voice.
I'm
doing well. God bless you.
This is quite
a good friend of mine,
Mike. I'm listening to.
Yeah, and we're glad to have you on. Believe me, boy, this is the only way I can get a conversation with you is let you come on the radio while I'm on. Fantastic. But it's good to hear your voice, Justice. It's good to hear your voice.
Well, likewise.
You know that, and I'd like to ask this to our Supreme Court Justice here. The cases that you see that come to the court, how have they changed in just the time that you have been there?
Well, you know, I started on the Supreme Court in just January of this year, and prior to that I was on the North Carolina Court of Appeals for 4 years. And the cases on the Court of Appeals, at least, I would say we are really becoming a more litigious society so that when people feel that they are being wronged, then they do pursue justice through the court system. And we know that over the history of time in the very ways that you all have been talking about it. And so the court cases are increasing. And they will continue to increase because there's going to be even more litigation concerning some issues that folks care about.
Well, you know, the thing is that I don't know how many civil rights cases you've seen when you're on the Court of Appeals or how many cases you've seen with the major corporation or a major moneymaker like, say, our art person versus a smaller person who's like the rest of us. David versus Goliath. How many of those have you seen when you were on the Court of Appeals?
A good number of larger corporation cases, quite a number of civil rights cases through the area of employment law.
Mm-hmm.
And some employment law and or discrimination based on race or gender or sexual orientation or the lack of accommodation for a physical disability or other disability. So those are actually and the more aware people become of their right to pursue action through the court system, the more cases like that we see. So
but
Justice
Beasley, can I ask you something? I don't even know if you can address this kind of issue or not, but in relationship to what is happening across the nation with all these legislatures, with what's happening with ALEC, what's happening with Civitas and all of that, do you see how critical it is and how threatening it is that we could actually be realizing and manifesting what Dr. King talked about in his speech about George Wallace when he said that his lips were dripping with interposition and nullification? Because it appears that everything that ALEC is doing, everything that the Koch brothers and Pope is doing, and that our legislature is doing, and a lot of these legislatures, is really trying to circumvent this Constitution of the United States and actually almost destroying their own state constitution and creating new laws where they have the authority is basically in the hands of the wealthy.
You know, I liked what you said earlier, which is that the I Have a Dream speech is a timeless speech.
It is.
It could have applied to the biblical times,
right.
And it would be applicable throughout the ages. And the one thing is it really doesn't matter, frankly, as much about what I think about what drives justicism. It matters what the people think. It's the people who drive the justice system. And when the people's wishes or the people believe that their rights have been curtailed, I mean, we already know that there are some lawsuits being filed, and there's word, you know, this is stuff that's in the newspaper about some of the legislation that's been recently passed. And you're right. I mean, a lot of what we have seen over the entire nation. So this is a trend that's going on. But it's also cyclical because we have seen lots of these kinds of things before, and I think that has a lot to do with that. People are concerned about that. That you know,
I want everybody to listen to this one little note here. Just listen.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Now,
that was
Paul Reinwick, who is known as the father of conservatism. Now, so this is, they never had this idea for everyone to vote, because the less people vote is when they get in.
Right. Like they have never been.
And they were, so this distortion of voter ID and.
Right.
To the college campuses and taking the precincts off the college campus.
Well, one thing, Michael, it's never been about voter ID. That was just a smokescreen. It's always been about voter suppression. And that's what he was alluding to. It's about voter suppression. They don't want people to vote. They definitely don't want minorities to vote. They don't want the youth to vote. They don't want people that are considered liberal or on the left to vote at all. So they're making laws to suppress the vote. It has nothing to do with voter ID. It's all about voter suppression.
Now, Justice Beasley, you, as a judge of the Supreme Court, anything concerning voter ID or any people that want to challenge that would go to the lower courts, and then it would go, if they wanted to go to the Court of Appeals, and then it would get to your court. Is that correct?
It could. Certainly it would start with the lower courts, but there could be a situation where the Court of Appeals might be bypassed, and then that matter would go straight to the Supreme Court.
Oh, so you mean they wouldn't even go to the Supreme Court of the state?
Depending on what area, and what I'm repeating to you, I've seen in the media, which is that there are some lawsuits being filed about voter suppression. Depending on what area of the Voting Rights Act is being challenged or what piece of the legislation, it could start out in the North Carolina system. It could go through, it could start out in the federal system. So it just kind of depends on what angle those lawsuits are filed under.
Okay, so it depends upon where they file the original claim then.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
But here's one of the things, Mike, and this is one of the problems. I think the Reverend actually alluded to earlier. You know, we aren't dealing with the blatant, you know, cross-burning, hood-wearing racism and stuff of the past. You know, they put up and put on suits.
We're dealing with their boss.
Well, yeah. Now, these people, because, look, they're really threatened, like we said. Their way of life is going extinct. Now, they're desperately trying to save it, and the way they're doing it is so broad-based and sneaky that it's hard to fight. And part of the problem is it's you know, they're waging economic war on people. Class war on people. They're doing other things. And so the effect is to suppress and destroy the middle class and the poor.
That's right.
But
exactly
racism, even though it is. And it isn't strictly, you know, it isn't harmful words, because they've learned to, you know, just sugarcoat everything.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's why we have, you know, voter ID instead of outright suppression, you know.
Right.
But this is all part of the same. I mean, that's why we have this ridiculous say. I mean, the Reverend said it earlier, but it is absolutely on its face ludicrous that we're at the same stagnant wages that we were when Martin Luther King was alive. You know,
that's right.
I mean, your minimum wage should be $22 or whatever now to even be the minimum standard of what
that's
it was.
Right.
In the 60s.
That's right.
Yeah.
But see, that is how pervasive their perversion of the system has become. And that is what's, I think, the real enemy. And I think this is a side of Martin Luther King everybody misses, is that they don't pay attention to the worker and to the economy. That is. That's what people forget. They always talk about race.
Right.
But, you know, poverty is universal.
Right.
You know,
right.
And
he was concerned about poverty because before he died, he started the Poor People's Campaign. And because he had gone to Memphis to fight with the sanitation workers, and as you say, most people forgot that that's where the direction they were going at that time. And we got to understand that Martin Luther King's program was very broad based; it was panoramic, and he tried to touch the issues that dealt with all of us. And the one thing that killed him is the same thing that they're trying to actually trying to kill Obama about, is about intervention of America in all these wars. When he spoke about the Vietnam War and how it was a heresy, because it was a war we didn't have to fight. It was a war that only benefited the wealthy and others. And because of that, you know, also that's another thing that people say that killed him. But Dr. King was involved in everything possible. He tried to highlight all the issues in America that would impact on the American people, whether they were the wealthy or the poor, but all, especially the lower class, the middle class, and those who were at that particular time being oppressed. And the problem with us is that in the last 40 or 50 years, and I'm saying this because of the fact that I've been a civil rights activist all those years, in the last 40 or 50 years, the only thing we talk about is the dream speech. We never talk about the actual application and the involvement and the dedication Dr. King had in making things change. And people think that the speech itself made a change. No, you have to do what he said at the end of the speech when he says, go back to Mississippi, go back to Alabama, go back to Louisiana, and do something, make a change. And we forgot that part, and people didn't make a change. And that's what happened in 2010, and that's what happened in 2012. And that's how Alec was able to come together and forge this very strong conspiracy, or this very strong propaganda instrument, and this actual, no, it's not even an instrument, this program of decimating democracy, because we decided we were going to relax, and we didn't do what we were supposed to do. We didn't keep our eye on the ball, and we became somewhat complacent, and they were able to move and make moves without people knowing it.
The other piece of that is, as you talk about the action behind Dr. King's words and the power, and how people were really moved to not settle for crumbs, but really move towards a better life for
That's
everybody.
Right.
And you're right, he was amazingly inclusive at a time
That's
when,
right.
as he was being discriminated against, he had every right, as so many other people, to be very angry about it and not either do anything about it or retaliate. And here we are 50 years later. And, you know, it seems to me that one of the most important things is while there's this push towards all-around action, there has to be re-education about voting because it's now changing again. And
That's
so
right.
people have to be aware of what the rules are. They got to be aware why they ought to care.
That's right.
And they're going to come to key people in the communities just like you all, looking for information and trying to figure out what the rules are, because I don't think people want to just sit on the sidelines now. I think people are going to be moved, and they're going to need to know how they need to be moved.
That's right. And that's the that is the impetus, that is the focus, that is the reason for Moral Mondays, and that is the reason why we're celebrating Dr. King and the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington in 13 cities around the state on Wednesday through the 13 different congressional districts, is because the one thing that Dr. Barber wants to do, the NAACP and all the other organizations, is we want to heighten people's consciousness, their attention, and make them aware of all the new voting changes, make them aware of the one thing that we got to do is stop talking about what's happening and doing something in terms of going and register to vote and go get somebody else and help them register to vote and start calling these legislators and calling your congressmen and all these people. There has to be some action. It has to be very, very engaging, very deliberate, very consistent, but it has to be in mass, because they have to understand that the masses are in rebellion, that the masses are angry and they are bitter and they want some changes. Because if we just sit by and feel like, you know, God is going to change this, he ain't going to change it unless we put our hands on it.
No. Justice Beasley, you are in the Supreme Court now, and what have you seen as the difference between the appellate court and the Supreme Court?
Well, functionally, we are different. The Court of Appeals is made up of 15 judges, and that court hears its cases by panels of three, whereas at the Supreme Court, we sit what we call en banc, or all of the seven justices sit together and hear all of the cases. And the standard upon which we hear cases at the Supreme Court is very different. There are some cases which come to the Supreme Court of North Carolina as of right, and then there are some that come out of the discretion of the court. But the importance of the particular case is, of course, considered, but also the Supreme Court looks at how that particular case might affect the laws or be a precedent for cases across the state. So the outlook is different, if you will.
Well, you are a judge in the Cumberland County District, and then you went to the Court of Appeals in North Carolina, and now the Supreme Court, and that's since 1999. Now, you're now in the highest court in North Carolina.
Say this about it too. Don't forget, the first black woman to ever win election.
Yay! Hallelujah. Praise the Lord. Thank you. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yes. And what I want to know from you is, do you choose, or do the members of the Supreme Court of North Carolina, do you choose or not choose cases like they do in the federal Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court?
We do, and let me just say, it is an honor and a blessing to serve at every level of the judiciary, and I have to give all the honor to God in not just the work that I do there, but just in everything in my life. And so, because I started in the district court, where we affectionately call it the people's court, where we are literally touching people's, you know, whether somebody eats or goes to jail or, you know, sues their neighbor. I mean, the impact is so much more immediate. I think that experience in my law practice really has made me the kind of judge that I am today. And so we do evaluate the cases as they come before us to determine what the impact is, yes, on the particular case, but what the impact might be in a far-reaching way in terms of how it impacts the law of North Carolina.
Yeah.
So the focus really is very different on the Supreme Court than it is at the district court level or the Superior Court level or at the Court of Appeals level. It's important work. That's the bottom line. It is very important work. And often people don't think that because it's the Supreme Court that it affects everybody's lives, but it does. Because what happens at the lower court level directly is impacted by what happens at the Supreme Court of North Carolina. So people have got to care about what's happening there and who's serving there.
That's right. That's
Well, one of the things, I think I mentioned this to you, Justice, when we last saw each other, I think it's completely ludicrous to have people who affect our lives directly not in the first part of the ballot when we vote. I mean, the justices, district, appellate, and appeals, and appellate and Supreme Court, if they're running, need to be the first item on the ballot. The president doesn't need the first. He needs to be the last person on the ballot.
Sure.
Because he doesn't affect us. And, you know, it's just completely ludicrous that the last person or people on the ballot are the court system, and 45% of them don't even check off.
Yeah.
I mean, because, I'm tired. But, I don't want to go that way anymore.
Then again, Mike, to be, you know, nefarious here for a minute. It's almost as if it were designed that way.
I think it was. But I also think one of the things is because most of us very seldom come in contact with judges on a regular basis, on a daily basis, sometimes maybe not in life. People just dismiss it. I mean, judges have impact on our life, but I'm talking about the average individual. You probably won't be in court, have to deal with the court maybe more than once or twice in your life, and maybe it's for a ticket then. But in terms of the seriousness of the laws that they have to impact, is most people don't recognize that. That's why it's not that they forget. It's just something that's not important in their life, you know, in terms of we know it's important. We know the impact that Justice Beasley and the other justices will have. But the average person, because they don't see judges every day in their life, because they don't necessarily have to come in contact with one, they don't realize, they don't visualize, they don't mentally perceive how important they are. And so when they get they deal with the people, they're going to see with the elected officials, they're going to see on a regular basis. They know that's going to be on TV. Judges don't be on TV on a regular basis. So there's somebody that's almost dismissed, even though they probably have a greater impact, like you said, Michael. And so that's what happens. And I think it's like the other brother was saying, it's by design. I think they should be up front, too, because they have such a great impact. But actually, the people don't ever really pay attention that much to them. Very seldom do people even pay attention to who the judges are, what they're doing.
By design or not, that's the way it is, and we need to do something to change it.
Well, the one thing that we can do is one thing we've been doing with the NAACP is we've been promoting, pushing, and encouraging people and sending out flyers and pamphlets and stuff about judges almost as much as we have about anybody else or even more. Because we know, especially now in this time, that judges are more critical than anybody else in what's going on in this country because they will have the authority to be the determining factors in a lot of things that happen. So I think it's the way we promote it, we engage it, and how we engage our public and help them to understand. And it's like Justice Beasley was saying, we got to do a lot more education. We got to do a lot more of developing relationships with people so they will understand the importance and significance of every elected official, but especially on the courts and especially about voting rights and voter suppression.
Well, that's one of my main things that I get tired about, people who think that the courts are nothing important or that they're some kind of, you know, vague, they wear white wigs and robes.
Right.
That don't matter.
Justice Beasley, do you wear one of them things?
I don't, but I just wanted to make sure. No, I don't, but I have gone to Britain and I've gone to some of the Caribbean countries.
Oh, okay.
And it's interesting.
But they do that in Canada as well, right?
Yes, they do.
They usually get their version of reality from TV, so I understand it. But the fact is, these are vitally important positions because they're going to determine, I mean, as soon as you're not paying attention, the next thing you know, they're going to do something move the Voter Rights Act, or they're going to tell you that a corporation is a person and has a vote. You know
right.
what I mean? So,
or they'll tell you that the district lines that were drawn were not discriminatory.
That
happened about a month ago.
I know, Reverend Pogue, you have to run, so I'm glad you called in, but I'd like you to call in next week.
Yes, sir, I'll do that, most definitely. And I do hope and pray that we can get everybody in this area, and I'm not talking about just Charlotte, but everybody in the area of this broadcast, in this broadcast area, will please come and attend Bringing the Dream Home. Bringing the Dream Home next Wednesday at 5 o'clock at Marshall Park in Charlotte, North Carolina. And if you have any questions, please call at 704-599-8904. Dr. William Barber will be our keynote speaker. But we will have other speakers from the surrounding area and in our city, well-known speakers. I'm going to try very hard after I get off this phone to get the justice to speak at this rally because she has benefited so greatly from the efforts of those who have gone before us in the civil rights movement and such people as Dr. King. So we might have to bring her up to get more people to attend. What do you think about that justice?
You're wonderful.
why we don't consider what justices are, because the House of Representatives has put in so many gag rules on justices
No,
you say hello to that person if he looks cross-sighted. You can't.
Right.
But how come the Supreme Court judges don't have the same
can say anything they want?
They can say they can go to any Klan meeting they want.
Yeah.
They can go out.
That's
to
right.
Any Alec meeting anyone.
Hey, and their family members can be the chief fundraiser. For
That's right. That's right. Isn't it amazing? So, Justice Beasley, you're free. I think you're free, and you have a right to come to our celebration next Wednesday if you're available. So do so, and don't worry about them. If Scalia can go hunting with Cheney, you ought to be able to come and pay respects to Dr. King at a rally.
Did you say face hunting? Did you say face hunting?
Right.
They went face hunting over you.
Thank you so much.
Right. We'll see you, Reverend Pogue. We will see you here.
Thank you, sir.
Next week. Thank you.
Reverend Pogue, I will talk with you too.
Yes, ma'am. I'll be trying to get in touch with you. I will because. You know, you're like a blessing. We've been talking about how the Lord blesses us. I was trying to find somebody in the legal community to come and speak to us next week.
Okay.
He sent me a blessing. I'll talk to you later.
Right. Okay. Okay, thank you. Justice Beasley, tell us you are running for office again, correct?
Yes, sir, I am. I am. You know, I was appointed to serve on the Supreme Court in January of this year, actually December of last year. And so I am filling the unexpired term of Justice Patricia Timmons Goodson.
Right.
And so that election will be, my election will be next year, 2014.
2014, November. November, correct?
I'm not sure if I have a primary. If there's a primary, it'll be May of 2014. If I don't, then it will be November 2014. That's correct, sir.
Okay, well, we'll see that you don't have a primary. But
she's run unopposed before.
What can we do to get you elected? How can we put out signs? We can call. Do you have a campaign set up already? What do you have? Or what can you do? And what can't you do?
Signs work, emailing your friends, calling your friends, letting me know people I should be talking with. You probably also know that the fundraising rules changed this last time in the legislature, such that when I ran for the North Carolina Court of Appeals, there was a public financing option. There is no more public financing, and so I am at this time also raising contributions to support my campaign. So there are lots of ways that people can help.
Do you have a website?
It is under construction, but it will be justicesherrybeasley.com. And my email address is justicesherry, and Sherry is C-H-E-R-I, beasley@gmail.com.
Okay, well, you come on again, and you tell us when everything is constructed and how we can get out to your first campaign event and how we can get a fundraiser to get something going for you.
Well, I very much appreciate it. I really do consider it an honor and a privilege to serve on the Supreme Court, and you have my pledge that I will, and I've always felt this way, justice is so important, and it's important to make sure that the system is accessible to all people. That was my promise as a district court judge, and that is my promise now. So I thank you so much for allowing me to come on here today, and we will definitely be talking soon.
Thank you.
Take care.
Our Supreme Court, our Supreme Court justice.
Yep.
And we have another call here. Hello, caller. Who's this?
Hello.
Hello. Yes. This is Lee Sowers. I was just calling to just listen in.
Oh, well, that's
fantastic.
Better. You can listen in.
You can even make comments if you would like.
You want to make a comment, or you just want to listen?
Well, I was under the impression that I was just catching the tail end of the conversation that you were having with the justice and the reverend there. I was under the impression that. That there was going to be some talk on the current CRB reform initiative going on in Charlotte.
Yes, we are going
to do that. We
just hadn't
gotten there yet.
We were still
the 50th anniversary.
Yeah,
things
we're
like
about
that.
15 minutes behind schedule because of the other people that got on. And, you know, if you give a reverend a bit of a microphone, he talks a little long. But we got a lot of good information from them. But we are definitely going to be talking about that.
Coming right up.
And as a matter of fact, we're waiting for our city councilman, Mr. James Mitchell, to call in. And we're going to be talking about that with him. And then we're going to have Matt Newton calling in, who's definitely going to be talking about it.
Yeah.
So,
well, that's good. I'm looking forward to that. I was at the actual county or city council manager meeting this past Monday, where a presentation was given.
Tell us what you think you heard. Or do you want me to tell you what I think it should be first, and then you can tell me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was there, so I mean, I know what I heard. I mean, it's there was a presentation given by a Willie Ratford, who.
Right.
Who was either part of this Community Relations Committee or the Citizens Review Board or works for the city. I'm not sure exactly what his capacity is.
I did.
But,
and that's a problem right there.
I'm sorry?
That's a problem right there.
Yes, exactly.
Oh.
The presentation was interesting, to say the least, from my perspective, because I have dealt with the issues directly, specifically, and that was not my experience when I went through the process. So it was very interesting.
Well, let's see who this is that's calling you right. Hold on just a minute. Let's see. Caller, who's this? Hello? Caller? Hello? Hello there. You just called in, caller. Who's this?
Michael, are you speaking to me?
Yes. Yes, we are.
Oh, it's Matt Newton.
Oh, hey. Well, I was waiting for
Michael, sorry about that.
But he hasn't called in yet. We have a gentleman who is listening and waiting to hear from you and waiting to hear about the discussion of the council review. And it's just that we're waiting for City Councilman James Mitchell to call in.
But this is our local lawyer, the expert on the Charlotte Civilian Review Board.
Yeah, there's a gentleman on the other line with us, Matt, who was calling in to hear about the council review.
Maybe you could give me a little overview.
Hey, Matt, this is Lee Sowers. So I guess I called in a little bit earlier. They were running behind schedule. So how are you? I remember seeing you at the city manager meeting on Monday, and I appreciate the effort you're putting into this to bring this to the surface.
Well,
it needs to be done.
Well, hey. Needs to be done. Well, listen, now, I was on the original committee back in, you know, the 20 Mule Team Borax commercial time, about, it seemed like 500 years ago, but I was on the original committee when they were starting to form this, and the ideas was supposed to be a civilian review board, not county review board, not city review board, not city council review board, not mayor review board, civilian review board. This ain't. And therein lies the problem. Now, there needs to be nothing else said.
I'm sorry to interrupt. The figures that were presented on Monday directly supports what you just stated. From what I saw on Monday, we have 80 complaints from civilians in the 16 years of existence.
More than that.
80 complaints of civilians, but there were 1,200 and some odd complaints from others.
Right.
Who are the others?
Yeah. Gee whiz. Well, maybe one of them is my dead dog who's buried in my backyard. But I don't know. The problem is it's supposed to be a civilian review board. And when you have someone like Ratchford, who's in charge of XXX, and he reports back to the city manager, who reports back to the city council, what does civilian get reported to? What does he get reported or she get reported to? Where is the civilian board?
I think important point to make too, Michael, is the fact that there is a complete and absolute lack of transparency from the standpoint of who's on the board, and we know a few of the folks. But it has taken law school.
Oh, right.
It has taken law school upwards of about 7 months through a Freedom of Information Act request to obtain the names. And then again, too, we know that they aren't technically all civilians or citizens, but not necessarily the makeup that, and I think you might have alluded to this last week, speaking of Patrick Cannon, but not the makeup that was first envisioned. Now, but having said that, there's also a complete lack of transparency as to the what the board does, the decisions that they make. We have just recently found out, right, over a 17-year period, that these decisions have all favored the accused, right, the officers, and never once favored the citizen. And that's something that I think the public had a right to know, since 1997.
Well, let me explain something. My understanding is that the FISA court is actually the Civilian Review Board, because they are just as unknown as the members of the FISA court. Yeah. Now, how does that work when it's supposed to be a civilian review board from the public? These guys are so anonymous, you have to have filed a petition to get who they are? Are you kidding me? Are these people getting paid? I hope not. Do we know that?
No, they're not. They are not. I applied to serve on the Community Relations Committee and the Citizens Review Board, both volunteer positions.
Then why is it secretive like the FISA court?
It wouldn't cost anything either. I think something that needs to be made clear, cities across the country have complete transparency with their citizens review boards. You can jump online. You can look at cities like New York, Philadelphia, San Diego, Atlanta, Boston, Salt Lake City. Type in their citizens review boards. They might be named something else. They might be police review board, for example. But they will tell you not just who's on the board, but they'll tell you their meeting minutes. They'll tell you the results of their decisions. And this is all open and transparent. And they do this under the umbrella of the particular cities within which they work. And so you have independent websites underneath the city's umbrella website, which is operated through the city. We could do that here in Charlotte, and we could do it free of charge. So there really is no excuse for not doing it.
Right. Can you guys just hold on 1 minute? We have our chairman of the Democratic Party, who has a short time. Chairman Bola, how are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm on my way to the airport in Phoenix.
You're on your way to the airport in Phoenix. And where are you going?
I'm flying back to the great state of North Carolina after a couple days out here at the DNC meeting and the ASPC meeting. Everybody knows that in North Carolina we are fighting some rather extreme elements, and people want to help us.
Oh, fantastic.
And that is wonderful to hear. I know you have a short time, but we were just talking about the Civilian Review Board, how untransparent it is, but what is very transparent is what these regressive knuckleheads are doing in the legislature in North Carolina. I mean, do they act like there is nobody living there in this state but them? And they can say and do whatever they want at will. And then our governor, who said he didn't even read the voter ID bill, he needs to be impeached for that. I mean, it's just incredible.
I mean, certainly, if the governor, he admitted to not reading the bill, that's right. One of the most important pieces of legislation that they have put forward and passed. When you're actually changing or playing around with people's right to vote, it's incumbent that all legislators and the governor understand fully what they're signing on to.
Well, so are you going to say now that when it gets rejected, of course this will get rejected, this is a bunch of garbage, this is stuff that these regressive malcontents are throwing against the wall like you would throw paint on a wall if you are a child finger painting. This stuff is not going to pass. So he's then going to say, you know, I should have read it, or, well, that's life, will be, well, what is he going to say when this is thrown back in his face? Because it will be.
I'm not sure what he can say to make an excuse for that, but clearly the point of a legislator is to be a deliberative body to actually make laws or not make laws, as may be the case, to reflect a changing and dynamic economy and state. And so to go in there and to run legislation willy-nilly and not understand or think about the unintended consequences of your actions. And let's not avoid the discussion of the Republicans were in no way, shape, or form ready to appoint people to these board of elections in all 100 counties, because you know how the system works. When there's a Democratic governor, we have two, they have one, and it flipped. And if you look at that film clip of Watauga County, you see a couple of young men that are adherents to their ideology, members of the Republican Party, that apparently have not read the memo or gone to any training at the School of Government to understand what their role is. And, you know, this is another case of not taking seriously your duties when you're serving in government or you're serving in an appointed position.
Right.
And that's,
but, you know, in their defense, you know, why should they pay attention and read the rules when the governor doesn't, you know? I mean, you know, they just follow the example of their leader, right? But, I mean, look, we're overburdening our system as we're cutting all the funding to our system, you know, across the board, whether it's education or anything else. But, you know, like I go down to the DMV just to get a license renewed, and you see lines all the way out across parking lots, down buildings, you know. And now they're going to require, you know, DMVs to also handle all the voter IDs for everyone. Again, I don't think the funding's there, the training's there, the personnel's there. They, you know, it's going to be a cluster, you know, once it gets going.
Has anything, do you know, Chairman, was anything said out there about the Attorney General, Eric Holder, suing North Carolina as his next step?
There were discussions of that. Obviously, I can't speak to what the Department of Justice will be doing, but people did mention in casual conversation that there's an interest, obviously, in what's going on in North Carolina and the rest of the country, and I wouldn't be surprised if you were to see some intervention. But obviously, I'm not privy to it.
Well, I know our senator has already written a letter. Senator Kay Hagan has already written a letter to Attorney General Holder requesting that he step down. So,
yeah, she has done that, Michael, and I, you know, I think people need to remember that our senator is representing all citizens when she's doing that. I mean, clearly, we stand firmly on the belief that we want everyone to vote. We want people to be involved in their democracy, to be involved and understand the civics of their community. And so when she does that, she's representing everyone. I just don't understand this philosophy of trying to cut off access to the ballot box, make people frustrated in their communities and their government, and then throw your hands up. I mean, that's what McCrory and the General Assembly are doing. They're making people feel like government doesn't work. Why should I get involved? You know, not staffing, not funding things, moving things around. People need to do what Ben Chavis said last Saturday, which is flood the polls. Which is what happened in Florida. People waited 14 hours to vote last year. Don't let these people push this on us. We need to double down, take this seriously, vote them out.
Well, didn't they say that one of the things they wanted to pass was no matter who's online, to cut it off, no matter if you have 1,000 people online after a certain time?
Yeah, they have all kinds of strange things in that 59-page bill. I mean, you know, I was asked by another reporter about the voter ID, which is what originally was the driving point of this. And then I said, wait a minute, you know, they got the voter ID, but you got to look at all these other things they put in there, cutting early voting, combining precincts, you know, allowing corporations to give state parties, which I call the Art Pope exception. I mean, they're doing pretty much everything under the cover of this theory that there was fraud. I mean, we all know what that was. It was a solution in search of a phantom problem. There was no problem.
Well, I was glad to see our former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Colin Powell, speak to that in North Carolina with Governor McCrory sitting in the audience and saying that, you know, there was a lot of voting fraud, but it was undiscovered. Well, how could you have undiscovered voting fraud and it be undiscovered? I mean, what, are you kidding me? You have all these votes, but the fraud was undiscovered? I mean, it's a laughingstock. But I know you got to run.
That's a theory, Michael, that they like to say, that they're preventing something that nobody can happen. So I guess they believe in Tinkerbell, too, you know.
Well, it's like what's the movie with Tom Cruise? Oh, Minority Report?
Oh, yeah. Right.
Minority Report. We're going to prevent this from happening because we know what you're going to think about doing.
Yeah, if you have the thought of something, might act on it.
You might act on it, right.
Right.
But we would change that and make
it. Hey, but you know what? Yeah. From the Republican side of things, they can then later claim that they have eliminated voter fraud.
That's right.
Just look at this.
You know, it's a logical setup, Michael, that's quite funny. My grandfather used to always say to me that he had signed a contract with 20th Century Fox to be a handsome actor, and then I would say, really? And he'd say, the problem is they didn't sign the other half. I mean, so you can say anything, but it doesn't mean anything.
Right.
You know, if they were in a court of law trying to prove that, they wouldn't be able to prove it because you were more likely perhaps to be struck by lightning than to really find the kind of fraud that they described. The state Senate investigated that. The numbers are available.
That's right. Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. What have you for us in your thoughts, Chairman Vola? What can you leave us with on this Friday?
What can I leave with folks this Friday? I would say that anyone in your listening audience needs to take very seriously your community and your municipalities, especially Charlotte, and show how much you care about your community by registering to vote, or if you are registered, vote in these elections. Municipal elections are just as important as presidential elections. They're not as sexy, and they don't get run on TV constantly, but get involved with your community. You're talking about a key issue when I was listening for the first 10 minutes. That's a community issue. That issue affects everybody, and people
Absolutely.
Need to take seriously these municipal elections and vote.
Well, I know you got to run, and it was great hearing from you, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from you next week again when you call in.
Thank you very much, Michael, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and your audience.
Thank you. That's the chairman of the Democratic Party in North Carolina, Randy Vola. Okay, Matt, and we don't have the first name of our caller. What's your name, your first name?
Lee.
Lee. Okay, Lee. It's Lee, right?
Yes.
Okay. Lee and Matt, an observation that I have is that the whole civilian review board needs to be scrapped and another one needs to be put in place that gives the civilian review board subpoena power. And they can have, if they're going to have 11 people on it, they need to have, if they want to have six elected people from office and five civilian or six civilian and five elected officials, fine. But this ain't working.
Right. You need to put the civilian back in.
When I spoke to Mayor Pro Tem Patrick Cannon a week ago, I said, you can't have 1,500 complaints and only have five or four or three go against the police department. Nothing in life is 100%. And he agreed. He said, no, you're absolutely correct. So, I mean, so what do you think about that, Lee?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I mean, I was at the luncheon on Monday, and one of the council members specifically said, well, I don't see that we should do anything. Why was the room full? Why were there so many police officers, so many people from the ACLU, from the Charlotte School of Law, and civilians and citizens who have experienced the problem? If it doesn't exist, then why were we there? So that's an excellent point.
the one problem with these things that it always drives me nuts is just the I don't care about the functioning of something or how it, you know, it's set up in their bylaws or any of this kind of junk. It's the impact of something. And if it's supposed to correct a problem or supposed to instill trust or understanding in the public, it should do so, right? I mean, that's just the obvious answer to something. And it always bothers me when you have things that are not transparent so that they may have the pretty name, but they do not do what they're supposed to do. And this is supposed to be a remedy to any kind of question about an arrest or a problem in you know, policing. And this gives a civilian the ability to have his case reviewed in public and see, you know, a just outcome in a transparent way. And when none of those things occur, then there is simply no trust in the public. You know, the public ends up distrusting police and distrusting politics.
That's right. Yeah. This is absolutely right. You know, when the public can trust our elected officials, which include the police department, fire department, whatever it is, the better the institution runs. When we have and you know another thing that bothers me? I don't like the word stakeholder. What the hell does that mean? I mean, that is, what the hell is stakeholder? I mean, it sounds like I'm at a racetrack or something.
I've done it to Western Sizzler.
No, the thing is that, the you know, if it's a police review board, they didn't want that name because they think that it's bad on the police. No, the better, I think police want this, the majority of them, because when you have something like this, it gives a blanket that every single policeman is doing the same thing. And this is a minority. This is, I mean, it's about the same minority as the illegal voting we have. So, you know, when everything is in the open and everything is, you can see through it like glass, everybody works better.
Yep.
Everything is better.
What What disturbs me is the fact that the stakeholder process, as it was defined back on April 1st by Mayor Fox, has been completed. The community, including the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, has had a chance to speak. We have all made our recommendations, and it was obvious on Monday that we all, for the most part, all on the same page. Mayor Fox had limited the time frame for this process 80 days, and not a day longer. And he made that extremely clear on April 1st. Well, we had hit 140 on Monday. And for those of us who were sitting in the audience, including you, Lee, you might comment on this as well. I think it was our common expectation that this would either be held in committee for consideration or sent to the floor of City Council. But instead, it went back to the task force for their recommendations. And what disturbs me here is that apparently for the committee, the recommendations of all the stakeholders, including the community and the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, just isn't sufficient for the time being. And I like that answer for that, you know?
Matt, before you go on, describe to us, who the hell are the stakeholders? What does that mean?
Stakeholders are anyone who have an active interest in the issue. And granted, I think from a very general, broad perspective, and I was just as confused as you were on this, Michael, when I first heard the term back in April, and this is what I gathered. From a very general, broad perspective, it's all citizens. However, the obligation or the duty or task that was given to the task force once it was assembled by the city was to identify stakeholders. And it ended up becoming two open call meetings for citizens, the law school, the police department, and a group of community organizations that took it upon themselves to band together and make recommendations on behalf of their constituents.
That's
garbage.
Well, right, exactly. I'm going through the handout that was given by Mr. Rathsford, and I believe there were like three different groups that were identified as stakeholders.
Oh, before we before we mention all these people's names, tell us who the heck is Rathsford? What does he do? How much money does he make? Who does he work for?
I do not know. I think Matt might have the better answer for that one.
Yeah, he is the he's the executive director of the Community Relations Committee. Community Relations Committee as a whole are citizens themselves who, just like Citizens Review Board members, volunteer their time. However, city staff regulates and instructs them pertaining to what they will do. And he is the overseer of that particular segment of city staff members who do that.
Why do we have this board? I mean, who the hell are they? Why don't we just have one board, a civilian review board? Why do we got to have 90 other layers between?
Yeah.
Well, we have a lot of overlap, and I think that's part of the issue here. The Citizens Review Board has a clear, defined purpose that it's not the same purpose as the Community Relations Committee. And yet we have a lot of overreach, don't we? I think really what's important here, and an important point to make, is the fact that the task force itself that's been assembled to make recommendations for the Citizens Review Board is predominantly made up of folks who are on the Citizens Review Board in the first place. And it's because of the blurring of the lines between the defined duties of each board and also the defined duties of city staff members.
I'll make a statement to agree with you, Matt. There were actually only two public meetings defined as, I guess, civilians or citizens, and I attended one of those, and it was very controlled and very directed. I went to the meeting to seek information, to try to get some answers that I went through the process and was not able to get, and I wasn't able to get any answers from this stakeholders meeting dealing with the public. It was very guided. We were very limited to the responses that we were made. It was very controlled. And government shouldn't be about manipulation and control. It should be about service and protection. And I didn't see that at all.
Well, I mean, I don't understand that. I mean, you know, we have supposed to have a CRB, and then they will go directly when they come up with their determination, present it to the city council. That's my estimation how it was supposed to work. You don't have to go to board A, and then board A sends it to board B and see if it's okay, and board B sends it back to board A, and then they shuffle around for 6 or 7 months, and then they say, oh, yeah, we like this recommendation. Oh, no, but board B says it. What the hell is going on here?
It's to have citizens give up. I mean that's exactly the process I experienced in going through it, too, with CMPD, with Internal Affairs, and then going finally able to get to this CRC to wage my complaint to take it to the CRB, which I didn't hear any response from. So I think you've identified the tactic. Now let's come up with a solution.
Well, in order to have the solution, all that needs to be gutted, and it needs to be the city council and the CRB. Yeah, the city council wants to throw in the city manager in there because they don't want to. Fine, okay. Nobody else. This is a complete waste of time. And don't our elected officials have more important things to do than to sit around and go to meeting after meeting after meeting and nothing is resolved? I mean, this is completely ludicrous.
It's on our dime. Yeah, it's on our dime, too, Michael. We hear so much about the powder keg that Charlotte was back in 1997, how similar we were becoming to Los Angeles. And I think I illustrated this point last week. However, our board, our Citizens Review Board, was stripped of all power when it was first created and absolutely pales in comparison to the board they have in Los Angeles. In Los Angeles, there's transparency. You can go on the website, learn about their particular Citizens Review Board. They have subpoena power. There's no defined standard of review, meaning that they leave it to the board to make their own independent decision without having to claim some sort of abuse of power on behalf of the police chief. And I think this is the most important point of all, the Los Angeles board or the Los Angeles system of government allows citizens, a citizens group to overturn the police department if they feel
right.
The police department made the wrong decision. All of these things are not unheard of. They're happening in Los Angeles. We talked about how close we were to Los Angeles then, and yet we are nowhere similar to this particular board. And I think that we could really look at this and say we should be.
Matt, you're sort of breaking up a little bit. You're sort of like you're far away, Matt. But what I was saying is, if they can do this in Los Angeles, and Charlotte can fit in one block of Los Angeles. I mean, this is Mayberry compared to Los Angeles. If they can do it there, with the diversity of the people that they have there, they can do it here. I mean, one of the things that I heard was, well, you know what? Maybe we, they're going to ask whether or not you need people who have a law license that know the law. Maybe it needs to be made up for that. I said, wait a minute. No. None of those people are on juries. None of those people, lawyers, except down in the Zimmerman case where the lawyer, his wife was on the jury. I mean, but besides that, I mean, you don't have to have lawyers. We are citizens. That's what it says, citizens. And
yep.
citizens
yep.
make decisions every day that affects the life of another citizen. When you walk across the street against the red light, you have made a decision that could affect somebody else. When you run a red light, you have made a decision that could affect somebody else. So juries are people like people. They're like anybody. As the old kickoff, Seussical the Musical says that no matter how small you are, you're still important. So therefore,
yes.
Yes. we need...
That argument's a red herring. As far as I'm concerned, Michael, saying that if we institute the changes that are being asked for, that the makeup of the board has to consist more of professionals is ludicrous. The board already has an attorney. There are defined roles for anyone else who happens to be a member that works in the administrative capacity. It doesn't change the fact that it needs to be made up of citizens, and that's the way it is elsewhere. The fact is that by giving the board powers that the other boards commensurate to the size of Charlotte has and allowing it to do its job better doesn't mean that we have to do anything different in as much as the qualifications for the makeup of the board. And I think to be clear, and something else that's important to know is the fact that anybody who's on the board has to undergo Citizens Academy training. They are trained to be in that position before they can qualify to be on the board. And they actually pay for that themselves. And so I don't understand why we don't trust them with more decision-making power.
Are you kidding me? Matt,
actually, I applied to the Citizens Academy, and my understanding was it's a pre-program. I was denied, of course, due to my experience. And I'm still trying to get some answers to that. But
are you a mass murderer or something? What experience were you denied?
I was a victim of an assault, and that's undisputed. And witnesses tried to report it; they were arrested.
Sorry, no citizen could be on the board that's a victim of any crime.
I mean, I was prosecuted at trial, and then the charges were dismissed. So, my charges were dismissed. I mean, I was prosecuted at trial, and the charges were dismissed. But apparently that incident prevented me from participating in the Citizens Academy and the community education workshops, which are also both free.
Every minute of this conversation, as Tommy said, gets worse. I mean,
I think Academy training is 50 hours, and maybe I'm mistaken as to cost there, but nevertheless, you know, these folks that sit on this board, they have training, and they are denied any opportunity to fully investigate the cases in front of them and make fully informed decisions, and I think that that's wrong. Why they also sign confidentiality agreements? Why go through all these procedural protections and then not give them the opportunity to make a real decision?
Yeah, Matt, you're coming in very weak, Max. Matt, you're coming in very weak.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, well you're absolutely right.
Because he speaks from an undisclosed location.
Are you speaking from an undisclosed location, maybe? That's the reason? But anyway,
I'm at the Mecklenburg County Courthouse. Yeah, maybe. Can you hear me better now?
They're grinding you out. Yeah, I hear you better now. The thing is, and I need to wrap this up here, Lee and Matt. The thing is that if we have a civilian review board that has investigated or has the ability to investigate what is presented in front of them, this is going to be the normal thing like every jury does. This will make some, I think it should make most policemen, because we're talking about the police department, we're not talking about the fire department, right? Or are we?
Just the police department.
And I think most policemen would consider that, hey, I think I am more protected by what goes on with a civilian review board, because these civilians are out in the street every single day, and they know what's going on.
Yeah. And it should just be a simple and transparent process.
Right.
It's kind of like, you know, when they put cameras on police cars. It wasn't,
absolutely.
It wasn't, you know, just so, you know, hey, let's be intrusive.
Right.
It was so that you could prove or disprove factually.
Absolutely.
When someone says, well, they didn't do that at the stop, or they didn't do that, or I wasn't speeding, or whatever. Well, you know what? It's a verifiable fact now.
Right.
And it's just transparent. Now, you can catch the cop doing wrong, and you can catch the citizen.
And we've caught some cops doing
wrong. But see, that is a simple, transparent, factual piece of evidence. Why can't we have a board that's transparent and open? It's just a simple review process. Why does it have to be convoluted?
Absolutely. Lee, can you tie up in a few words, short words here, before I get to Matt, what you feel the CRB should be, and or whatever statement you would like to make?
Well, yeah, they should have more power, definitely. And it should be made up of citizens. I mean, if it's a citizens review board, actually there is a civil service board that deals with the police officer complaints. That's a separate issue. So the citizens review board should be made up of citizens, not employees of the city, not appointees from city council that, I guess they would have to be appointees from city council, but how are they selected? I mean, that raises other questions. But it shouldn't be made up of citizens, and they should be given the power to actually investigate complaints and help get the citizens the answers that they need. I mean, citizens going into this process, they don't have a clue. All they know is something was wrong. Something failed in the system. Where do I go to get a resolution? And the only answer I heard from just about everybody is, well, you have to hire a lawyer. Well, we pay our taxes for the police to protect us. Why do I have to hire a lawyer now to get the police to protect me? That would be my final statement.
And it should be a transparent civilian review board that is not hidden like the FISA court.
I agree.
Do you agree with that?
I agree.
Yes, Lee. Matt?
Yes, sir.
What do you have to...
I agree wholeheartedly with everything Lee has just said. And let's be clear, too, not everybody can afford to hire an attorney, especially with some of the smaller infractions that we see going through internal affairs. And so it's a necessary part of our city government that is meant to instill trust within the police department and within our city hall, and it works on both levels, doesn't it, for both sides here, because we have seen an instance over the past 5 years where two police officers were shot on the east side in the Timber Ridge apartment. And I think the argument, and this is what was explained to me by the NAACP, the argument can be made that this was the result of an erosion in the public trust with the police department. So what we're talking about here is we're talking about strengthening not just the community, right, and their ability to seek redress, but also strengthening the police department and internal affairs responsibilities and responses to the community. And so it's an approach that is meant to be all-inclusive and to be consensus building. And we certainly don't have a board right now that has the powers it needs to do its job. So we need to instill within it the power to make fully informed decisions through subpoena power, the power to actually be effective, so bring down that standard of review. And then also we need to be able to know exactly what they're doing. So if there ever came a time where we need to hold them accountable, we can't. And that's all that we're asking for here. I don't think it's outrageous. It certainly isn't expensive or cumbersome. And it seems as though all the stakeholders that were identified are all on the same page. We're going to be going on somewhere along the lines of 150, 170 days, maybe even more, before city council actually makes a decision on this. And then who knows? Maybe take it to the floor. So hopefully we get there sooner than later.
And we need to change that stinking name, stakeholder, which is completely ludicrous. One other thing I'd like to ask you, Matt, is you might know this better than Lee, and that is, who would the CRB answer to if you were set this up?
Well, the CRB, technically they answer to the city manager. It's a separate board entirely, so whenever they make a decision, they're going to initially relay that back to the police department, the chief of police, and also the city manager. If it came down to it, and we haven't seen an instance of this, of course, but if it came down to it where they did make a decision that was inconsistent with the decision of the chief of police, well, they would relay that to the chief of police and the city manager, at which point the chief of police makes another independent decision before the city manager acts, and the chief of police will advise the city manager. At the end of the day, I suppose the buck stops at the city manager.
Okay, well, no, but I'm not talking about this convoluted setup we have right now. Because this don't work. You got to jump the whole thing. I'm talking about when there's a severe review board only. No other vice boards, no other A, B, and C boards, the civilian review board. How would the head, the president or the chairman of the civilian review board, who would they, he or she, answer to?
The citizens. I mean, that would have to be the simple answer. How do you arrive at that, though?
Well, see, I don't know if I agree with that perfectly, but they would have to answer, or let me put it wrong, maybe I said it the wrong way. Who would they now say, this is what our decision is? Who would they give that to?
I see.
Well, ultimately, Matt? I think it depends upon the framework of the system that you have. And what we're talking about a system that is fair. And in so doing, it can either be a system where the city manager makes the final decision. If that's not what we think is fair, then it's a system where through the appointment process, it's the city council, and so the citizens review board would be the ones who would make the final decision. That's what you see in cities. Citizens making the final decision in cities like Los Angeles and Chicago and Detroit. But due to the fact that they're appointed, the buck in that respect stops with the city council members. If you disagree with the decisions of your citizens review board, well, then you need to elect new city council members to appoint new members of the citizens review board.
Okay, that means that the city, civilian review board, would hold the city council members responsible, because the city manager, he can't hold them responsible because he only works for the city council. So that means at the next election date, we got to remember what they did.
I knew where you were headed with that, Michael.
Okay.
All right. So, anyway.
Which then in turn would put it back in the hands of the citizens if they actually go out to vote, which you guys spoke about before. So.
You're absolutely right, Lee. It goes back in the hands of the citizens. And the final instant, it's in their hands. And we got to remember on the city council who did what and why and when. And that's what
and
it
if
is.
It's transparent, right? If it's transparent, that information should be available through city council
right
meeting minutes
page,
and so on and so forth.
Right, on, right, it should be available right on the front page of the Observer.
Well, good luck
right
with
now.
That. I would prefer to have it on a website that I can actually go read it on my own and come to my own conclusion.
I want to thank you, Lee, and I want to thank you, Matt, for giving us this great introduction into magic on the Citizens Review Board.
I want to invite folks to come on out on Monday night. We're going to be asking people to wear black in support of the speakers we'll have going in front of City Council during the Citizens Forum portion of their meeting. That will be 6:15 p.m. Monday night at City Hall. The meeting chamber is on the first floor. To learn more about reforming this process, please go online, crbreform.com. You can also jump on Facebook, CRB Reform Now. Thanks, Michael.
Okay. I want to thank you, Lee. Call back in. Because you seem to be very intuitive.
Thank you, Michael.
And you know what you're talking about. So call back in time. Thank you, Matt.
All right.
Thank you, Lee.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Did I just cut off somebody? Yes, I did. Oh, I'm sorry. Call back. I just cut you off.
Jeez,
yes,
Mark.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I shut up somebody. They've been out there holding on for a long time, too. I'm sorry. But right now, we have two people on, and we got to speak to, if I can, I got to speak to a couple of people here, but it is, and it is.
Full transparency, Mike.
This is full transparency. This is.
It's the doctor in the house. Doctor in the house. It is our resident doctor, Dr. Grace Lynn Galloway.
Grace Welby.
Yes,
Grace
Welby. Hello.
Grace Welby.
Hello.
How's it going?
Indeed. Yes. How are you, Michael?
I'm doing fine.
We've been talking about we were suffering here in Charlotte under a case of transparency flu. So,
right.
How's it going? Sure, well.
And I need to to let this other gentleman on. Robbie, can you hold on just a few more minutes, Robbie? Robbie.
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you can you hold on just a few minutes? The Grace has got to go. I just want to get through with her, but then I want to have a long talk with you.
Sounds great. Sure.
Grace, did you meet Robbie Wells at the convention?
Yes, I did. Did I not shake your hand, Mr. Robbie? I know I did. Yes, I did.
We did. How are you doing today?
I am doing just fine. What kind of a shenanigans and shiggity are you up to, Mr. Robbie?
Well, we're going all the way across the country, of course, campaigning. I just happened to be home this weekend, but of course, next weekend we'll be over in Fayetteville, the home of Fort Bragg and the 82nd Airborne. I'm the keynote speaker at Warrior Jam. They're expecting over 8,000 people there, so we've
awesome.
Got that going on. Yeah.
Awesome, awesome. Hey, Robbie. So I should talk to you. I need to tell you. Are you aware of the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the Vietnam War? You were aware of the bill that was actually passed by Congress? My gosh, Congress actually did something, a couple of, not this Congress, the last one, where they passed a bill actually funding the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the Vietnam War.
Right.
And the idea and the concept is to bring the recognition to the Vietnam veterans that they never received. So
Well, yeah, I did know about that, and I'm happy that it happened. It's way late, but, you know, it's better late than never. But I will say this, the veterans are very dear to my heart, and if you look at my platform and some of the components of it, you'll see that, you know, I want to do a lot of things for our veterans. We've got over 800,000 veterans right now that are homeless here in America. That makes absolutely no sense. Right.
Yeah, and it's unconscionable and should never happen. But anyway, we are starting this. So Robbie, you and I have to talk. I know you're campaigning, but you and I have to talk because I think this is something as a veteran, it would signify to other veterans that they've not been forgotten.
Absolutely.
Well, I completely agree, and you know, hopefully Michael's going to talk to me a little bit about my plan that will actually put back about 500,000 veterans, put them back to work.
I'm going to ask you about it.
Good. Michael, I'm going to sign off because I want to hear what Robbie has to say.
Well, I before you sign off, I want to know, what did you think about last week's shenanigans at the convention?
Oh, what do I think about that? You don't want to know, do you? Yeah, you do. Well, it went better than I thought because we did get some good things accomplished. But, you know, here's how I feel about these last-minute nominations from the floor. Okay, here's how I feel. If you don't have enough guts to run for this office in enough time to let us vet you, because, you know, you need to be vetted by people. People need to be able to know you. So I really, you know, I know the democratic process is that, yes, anybody can be nominated from the floor, et cetera, et cetera. I know that. But by golly, I'm not going to even mention this, but whoever was wanting to run, okay, has the courtesy to the body of the Democrats to let us know 2 weeks before or in enough time before so that people can get to know you so that we know who we are voting for. You know?
Now, there's a special circumstance where you can nominate someone. But there was no special circumstance.
Patty Keever, she was one of these people that came out against President Obama.
Absolutely.
She said she was not going to support President Obama or not. And so, you know what? And now she's running for. So that irritated me because she didn't come back and say, oh, I'm sorry. I did. You know, it was a political ploy. And she said, no. So
I am not going to support him, but when it comes down to it, I'll vote for him. But I mean, what are you, a ballerina? I should see you at Carnegie Hall, not running for office.
Yeah.
The thing is that this is conservative mindset.
Yeah.
This is what it is.
So,
I mean, you know, you don't see any liberal Democrat saying, I'm not a liberal Democrat. They always say, no, I'm a Democrat. They're not running. I am right here. Michael Watson, a liberal Democrat. And I ain't afraid to say it to anybody. Forget this progressive bull. That's some big thought that came out of somebody's mind. Progressive in what way? Well, how are you? You like broccoli, but you don't like spinach?
That's just a reaction to Roe making liberal.
Right. So, but that's the thing. But get off that dog for a minute. I'm sorry, but anyway, I want the baby to run be nominated for the floor at the next convention.
I agree. I think yes. Let's do it. Okay.
Let's do it. What's going on with the health care clinic?
You know, every week it gets worse. Every week it gets worse. I don't know what to tell you. I had one patient that came into me and she said she's been cut off food stamps and her husband's been cut off unemployment. So they have no money. They have nothing. No food in the refrigerator. Isn't that great?
Well, who's the one that said that? Was it Cruz that said, no, we don't need Raphael? Wasn't his name Raphael Cruz? Right.
We don't need no stinking food stamps.
That
what the heck?
you know, things with
him. Anyway.
He said, let him go to the emergency room.
Yeah, that's what they said. You know, get him go to the emergency room. Unbelievable.
What's that all the
Michael,
hospital? Yes.
Michael, I got to run. Okay,
all right,
I'm going to listen to you guys. All right, take care. Robbie, good luck.
Bye.
Thank you so much.
Robbie, for people who don't know you, this is Robbie Wells. He's a former college coach, head coach of Savannah State University. And
49th history, by the way.
We did. So the Constitutional Party nomination for President of the United States in 2012. And he is now
independent.
Now, Robbie, tell us something about your personal life that the people would like to know.
Well, you would like to know about my personal life, Michael, or do you want to talk a little bit more about what I'm actually trying to do right now? Now, as far as my personal life, I live in the university area of Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm a homeowner right there in the university area. I attend church right here in Charlotte. I go to the fastest growing church in America, which is Elevation Church, and I volunteer every Sunday that I'm actually in the area. Of course, being the fact that I am running for President of the United States in 2016, there's a lot of weekends that we're on the road, but this weekend I actually will be at the Blakeney campus. Of course, that church has seven different campuses, but as far as my personal life, I'm a small business owner now here in the university in the North Charlotte area, and we have a small marketing and delivery business, and we've got about eight employees that work with us. Most of my professional career, of course, was spent coaching college football, and of course, my last position, I was the head football coach at Savannah State University. I've got a burning desire to serve this country. This is not something that just came upon me at the spur of a moment on a whim. I've known since I was 8 years old that one day I was going to be prepared enough to run for president because I saw a family friend of mine when I was 8 years old actually become the president. You see, Jimmy Carter became the president back in 1976, and my father, who was a Baptist minister, they adopted me when I was 6 weeks old. By the way, I was an adopted child. But my father actually sat on a committee when Jimmy Carter was the governor of Georgia, and my father sat on a committee and worked with Jimmy Carter to oversee the special needs kids in the state of Georgia because I had an older sister that was special needs. So I saw my family friend go from being a farmer to being the governor and on to being the president of the United States. So, you know, it just kind of stuck with me that one day I was going to do that. I'm one of those guys that sat down a long time ago and wrote out all my goals, everything that I wanted to do professionally, personally, family goals, spiritual goals. So I'm chasing after probably the largest goal that I had written down, which is, of course, to become the president of the United States. And I have every intention to be number 45.
Well, that's fantastic. That right there is the American success story in a nutshell, doesn't it?
Well, as I mentioned to you, Robbie, before, that Jimmy Carter was no peasant farmer. He was a peasant. He wasn't even a peasant peanut farmer. He was the peanut farmer. Or one of the big ones. But, hey, do you know anybody else that you grew up with that this even came into their mind that, you know, I want to do that. Knew it that early.
Well, you know, I don't know if anybody my age that it came into their mind. Now, I did have the opportunity to meet a 12-year-old child this past year when I was out campaigning in Illinois. And she intends on being the president of the United States. Her name is Daphne Ahrens. And I told her, I said, you know what? That's a dream that I had back when I was your age, and I kept it. I said, I hope that you keep that, and you do go and pursue it and actually achieve it. And I told her, I said, of course, you know, by the time that she actually runs, I will be done. But I told her that as long as her her platform is in line with getting this country back to economic greatness and getting us moving in the right direction, that I would be on board with her 100% come 24 years from now.
24 years.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. You know, I think a child's dream that, you know, it's up to us as adults to make sure that we nurture these children. And that's part of my platform. We've got a major problem with our future generation right now. We're going to leave them with a huge amount of debt. We've got almost $17 trillion in debt right now, and that continues to grow. It's our job to leave the future generation a better America than what we had. It was my father that taught me when I was a young child, so whenever you take a job, make sure you leave it better than when you got the job. Which is one thing I've always prided myself in doing. In fact, if you look back over my career, I've always gone into situations that were probably, in everybody else's terms, they were in shambles. People thought I was crazy when I took the job at Savannah State because it was absolutely the worst Division I football program in the entire country. But we quickly turned it around, and in that first year, we won as many games that first year as they had in the previous 5 years combined before I got there. So we're going to take that same type of mentality. I know a lot of people say a football coach running for president. Well, we actually had a movie star and we had a peanut farmer that had been president. So why can't we have a football coach that's got some proven leadership ability, no nonsense leadership ability, which is what I think that we've got to have to go to Washington, someone with thick skin and a backbone that will not bow down and buckle under to these special interest groups and lobbyists, which have been plaguing Washington for at least 30 years now. And because they plague Washington, they plague the entire country.
Well, you know, a peanut farmer worked a lot harder than a movie star. Most movie stars just take orders from the director. The peanut farmer is doing it all himself. So, you know, this is a I need to ask you this question. Why do you want to be president of the United States, the highest, I would say, the highest position in this entire world?
Well, you're exactly right. You say it's the highest position, Michael, and I appreciate that question. You know, I am one of we the people. I've gone through the same struggles, and I'm answering your question with this statement. I've gone through the same struggles that 99.6% of our population here in America has gone through. What is 99.6% of us? We're considered to be middle class and below. You see, I am not a multimillionaire like Mitt Romney or anybody else that's been put out there. I am a middle class citizen that has felt like my American dream has been stolen from me and replaced with an economic nightmare. I wake up every morning wondering how I'm going to provide for my family, just like I know millions of people across this country feel the same way. We've got 20 million plus Americans that are unemployed. I've been there. I've gone through the unemployment lines. I know what it feels like. It's devastating. I've been underemployed. We've got 25 million Americans that are underemployed right now. I've served in this country, which means I represent everybody that's in the military right now and all of our veterans before. You know, over a third of our population has been touched by the military in some shape, form, or fashion. I'm standing up for all those people. I'm standing up for the special needs people. I'm standing up for the educators. I'm standing up for the children. I'm literally standing up for everybody across this country that is saying, hey, enough is enough. It's time for us to get back to the basics so that we can right this ship and start moving this thing in the right direction. Now, we're doing a lot of things that are good, but we've got a lot of things that we can improve on with our economy, with the debt, with bringing our troops home, with putting people back to work. And, you know,
okay.
I'm talking about
staying right there. What would you do with the troops coming home? Because you got to remember now, this is not like Vietnam or Second World War or the First World War where we had draftees. These people volunteered, and to me, that's the problem right now, because I would institute the draft again, where every single person, no matter if you're a billionaire son or a poor peanut farmer, you served in the military. I mean, they do that in Israel. Every person who stands, who's born, has to serve a year or a year and a half, I don't remember what it is, in the military to help their country. Because, you see,
right.
Well, we have, you know, I would give kids, I was in charge of all the volunteers for General Wesley Clark when he ran for president. And that's what he wanted. He wanted to have every person that served in the military would get 2 years free education in college, any college they want, because of their ability to serve in this military. And we are killing these people. These people volunteered, and we're ripping them apart. And the reason why is because people in this country don't care, because they don't have any peace in the action. They don't care.
Well,
that's why
they have not. There's a lot of people that have not invested in this country. You're exactly right. And you know, in fact, if you look at part of my plan, you know, this amnesty bill that they've got up in Washington right now, I don't agree with it. I don't think it protects anybody. It doesn't protect the American citizens. It really doesn't protect the illegal aliens that we have right now. Let me just say this. I am for immigration. We are all descendants of the immigrants, unless, of course, you're Native American descendant. But, you know, pretty much everybody in this country got here because their descendants immigrated here, or either they did themselves. So I am for immigration. What I will say about the illegal immigrants that are here, I've got a plan that I truly believe that would work a whole lot better. Number one, we've got to secure our border, and my plan would actually quadruple our border patrol on the Mexico-United States line. At the same time, as president, I would work with the border states, the governors of the border states, so that they could get the Army National Guard to actually back up the border patrol. In other words, the Army National Guard, they have to go and they have to run their drills every month anyway. Why can't they just go do it down towards the border? What that would do is deter a lot of the criminals, such as these drug cartels, from freely roaming into the United States, and especially down across our border towns, from terrorizing our citizens.
I just want to interrupt you for a moment. So you would have the National Guard from Albany, New York, go down there to the border?
No. Our border states. I would strictly work with the governors of the border states.
Okay.
Is California, New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, of course.
But there's a problem with that, because 90% of them are in Afghanistan, in Iraq.
Well, you're right. And my number one concern is let's be constitutional on this. We've got 179 countries on the face of this planet, and we've got Army troops in 160 of them. We've got to bring these troops home as quickly and safely as possible from around the globe, and I understand there's certain spots on the globe where that's going to be a lot longer than others, such as South Korea. We're not going to get out of South Korea for a good long time. That's just the reality of the situation. But all these other places, I truly believe that we can bring them home. It was George Washington that warned us of these foreign entanglements with all these other countries. He warned us of that in his farewell address. So I would bring these troops home as quickly and safely as possible. We can have a military presence around the globe and be constitutional in peacetime. Article 1, Section 8 says that our Congress can provide and maintain a Navy. So what I would do is I'd have Congress just enact that. Let's have our Navy put into the hot spots of the globe. And if you think about what our Navy is, we've, of course, got the fleet, we've got the personnel, we've got amphibious capabilities with the Marines and the SEALs if we had to go on land, but we've also got air support with our naval aviators. That's constitutional. At the same time, we're saving a lot of money because now we're going to bring all our troops back home. Now, if you want to deter war...
The Navy is already in every hot spot in the world. They're everywhere.
Navy is
spread in the ocean. Pacific Ocean.
We're also the police force that keeps open every canal.
I mean, they're
out.
I agree with that,
but what I'm saying is we need to bring these troops home that are on boots on the ground, okay? We've got a modern-day empire, and I love studying history because history always repeats itself. Now, if bad things happen in history, we need to take it and apply what we've learned so we do not see that happen again. What we've seen in history with modern with empires in the past, empires always fall. That's why we've got to reel these troops in. You know, we've got to protect the United States of America and the people and the citizens of this country.
What do you do with them when they come back?
Well, you've got to maintain your army. There's two things that deter war. And that is a strong economy and a strong military. We still need to keep our army very strong. We just got to maintain them here. At the same time, we've got to have a stronger economy. We've got to bring these manufacturing jobs back. And there may be some people that want to argue with me on this, but we've lost 4.5 million jobs in the past 15 years strictly because of NAFTA. So I am a president that would push to repeal NAFTA so that we can start bringing these manufacturing jobs back. I will work to push towards fair trade instead of free trade. Fair trade means that goods that come into this country, we would actually raise the tariff on them so that companies here in the United States can actually compete and make the same product, the comparable product, at the same price. That's what's going to bring a lot of these companies back that are overseas right now.
But Robbie, would you create a trade war then? What happens then?
Yeah, it would collapse the world economy.
That would collapse the world economy.
I don't know if it would collapse the world economy. What's going to collapse the world economy is if the United States economy actually collapses. And I think that's kind of the course that things are on right now if we don't take some corrective steps. You know, we didn't get here overnight where we are with our economy. And it's not going to get fixed overnight either. You know, I like to use this analogy because this breaks it down real simple. You know, if someone goes to their physician says, look, I've got this huge tumor on my back. Can you get rid of that tumor? And the doctor says, sure. Pulls out a knife and just whacks that tumor off. Well, that person's probably going to bleed to death because he did it too quickly and because he didn't tie off all the blood vessels. In order to remove that tumor correctly, that doctor's got to go in there and surgically and very carefully, meticulously remove that tumor. And when he gets to the blood vessels, he has to tie them off so that that patient doesn't bleed to death. We've basically got to do the same thing here in reeling this thing back in so that we can take care of our
arm. I agree with you 100%. But don't you think our present president, Obama, is doing the same thing, strategically trying to remove that lump on your back surgically?
Oh, I completely agree. The only problem is... Like I said, it's going to take years. I mean, it's not an 8-year process. It's a process that's going to take 30, 40 years. But you've got to have people that are truly dedicated to doing it back to back to back up there in Washington.
Yeah, you know, if you got there, you can only be there for 8 years. So what happens after the next 30, 40, 50 years?
We got to make sure that the people of the United States elect someone that truly understands what we've got to do to continue reeling this thing back in.
Okay, no, you're absolutely right with that. The problem is that people don't know who to pick because the media directs them who to pick.
Right. Well, I completely agree with you on that. And let me just say this. Of course, I'm a competitor. 20 years coaching college football, I never went into a game, Michael, to lose. I'm probably one of the fiercest competitors you're ever going to talk to. So when I tell you that I'm in this thing to win, I am truly in it to win. Yes, I'm listed as an independent right now, but very quickly now we're getting ready to make an announcement that we're going to be joining one of the two major parties simply because I truly believe that I've got a platform that will help the people of the United States. If I didn't believe that, I wouldn't be running for president. So we're actually going to make an announcement here in the next couple of weeks that we're going to be joining one of the major parties. And obviously, Michael, you know which way I'm leaning. You know, I'm just not ready to make that announcement today. If I announced it today, then it's out and it's everywhere. But we are going to make that announcement.
You're going to make the announcement on my show.
Well, let me just tell you this. This next weekend, on August 31st, I will be speaking. I'm the keynote speaker. In fact, I'm the only speaker at Warrior Jam, which is going to be held in Fayetteville, North Carolina, next Saturday, a week from tomorrow. And that's going to be the home, of course, of Fort Bragg and the 82nd right. Airborne Division. They're expecting over 8,000 troops at this event, plus a lot of veterans and a lot of civilians as well. It's going to be Labor Day weekend, so they've got 13 bands, I believe, that are going to be performing all sorts of music from rap to country to rock, all sorts of stuff. And they've sandwiched me right in between all of them, and I'm going to be speaking, and I'm going to be talking about my platform, what I truly believe we've got to do to get this country going back in the right direction. You see, this is not a left-wing thing, and it's not a right-wing thing. This is about the bird that sits in the middle, and that's what I am. I'm the bird that sits in the middle. I've never seen a bird fly with one wing anyway. We've got to start working together as a nation. We need a president this next time around that's going to add on to what President Obama said back in 2004 and 2008 when he was running the first time. We need a president that's going to actually bring people together from all walks of life. You know, it was Martin Luther King that said that he dreamed of a day where a man would not be judged by the color of his skin, but he would be judged by the content of his character.
Right.
So, you know, I truly believe you've got to have the right attitude at the top. If you've got the right attitude at the top of any business, organization, team, government, then that attitude permeates its way throughout the entire business or government, whatever. So we've got to get the right attitude in the Oval Office every time we do elect a president, because if we don't, it could be detrimental to this country.
Well, what do you think about these Republicans that want to spend regressive jerks that want to spend an entire term voting for the same bill that will never get voted and handed to the president?
I truly believe that we've got politicians in Washington that are more concerned with keeping their job than actually doing their job. They go to Washington, they want to point the finger, cast the blame, and not really deal with the true problems and helping the people and their constituents back home. I can promise you this. When I go to Washington, I'm not going to be concerned with keeping my job. I will be concerned with doing my job and making sure that Americans have jobs. And if I do that, I'll get reelected.
Okay, but here's the thing, that the president is the CEO, and he don't know what the idiots are doing down in the mail department. So the president has no power, really. If legislation doesn't get to his desk, there ain't a damn thing he can do about it.
Well, let me just say this, okay? And I know that he was a Republican, but one thing that I do like that Ronald Reagan did, whenever Congress, you know, started slow playing things and not wanting to do their job, what did he do? He went to the American people. He held a press conference and said, look, you elected me and I told you I wanted to do this and here's what I want to do, but they're standing in my way. So pick up your phone, call your legislator, your state legislator, and let them know that this is what we've got to do. And, you know, that's one thing as President of the United States,
but
I'm willing to do.
But that was a million years ago, and the people in office right now are calling for the president's impeachment. I mean, this is how dumb they think the people are that they're talking to. The impeachment of the president, for what reason? And they never say. I mean, we just had Colburn on talking yesterday at a group of people. I'm looking at him right now again to show it on a hardball. Him talking to a group of people and saying, you know, I guess I don't want to talk about that, but I guess this could lead. He said, now, I'm a very good friend of the president. We were friends together. Our wives went out together because we came into office in the Senate at the same time. But this man is saying to these people, you know, there are things going like this. It could be a possibility of impeachment. Now, that never happened to Reagan. I mean, Ronald Reagan and the Speaker of the House
on opposite sides would go out and have a drink together. You never in this house today. These people, and the only reason why, no matter what any other moron says, it's because he's black. If he was not African-American, this garbage would not be happening.
Well, and let me break in and say, you know, I'm sure that a lot of what you're saying has legitimacy too. You know, I've actually seen racism on both ends. Of course, I've actually been the victim of it in the past. And what I will tell you is this: I am not a victor or victim. I am a victor. Okay, I overcome what is going to be put in front of me, and I know that President Obama will do the same thing. Now, that whole talk about impeachment and the whole nine yards, that's not going to go anywhere. You guys know that, and I know that too. Okay, that's not going to happen. But what we've got to have is start electing officials on both sides that do not have so much hate in their heart towards the other side. Because here's the thing. You've got two sides and two philosophies. We can find common ground, and we need a president in 2016 that's going to be able to come in there and say, hey, look, we may not agree on everything, but we agree that we love the people of this country. And at the end of the day, after we've fought there in Congress, you know, we can shake hands and agree to disagree if we've got to. We can go and have a drink together if that's, you know, what we used to do, and get back to just being true Americans. Because, you know, we've got to have the best interests of the people at heart. You know, there's people out here that are truly hurting right now. We've got 39 million Americans that live in poverty right here in the United States, yet we're giving away $50 billion, with a B, dollars a year in foreign aid. See, as president, what I want to do is keep that money right here in the United States. Imagine if we broke that $50 billion up over 50 states, and every state got $1 billion every year to work on their infrastructure, on jobs, to eliminate homelessness, the whole nine yards. So, you know, I'm one, yeah, we can sit there and we can point the finger and cast the blame, or we can come up with solutions. And coming up with solutions.
Well, you know, the famous person James Tiberius Kirk said one day, he said, I don't believe in a no-win situation. But he didn't have to deal with this Congress, because this Congress will not pass nothing. And they've shown it by the amount of bills they have passed. They brought up 40 bills to kill Obamacare. Now, if that isn't just the dumbest, you know, what's that say about the comments they say about repeating the same thing over and over again?
That's a sign of insanity.
It's insanity.
Doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result is the absolute definition of insanity. So, you know, you're exactly right. Now, I would just tell you this. You know, we've got to get the citizens across this country to start taking ownership in this country, so that this doesn't go on. We've got to have politicians that are elected that are truly going there for the best interests of the people, instead of just going there to fight the president, which is what's going on right now and what has gone on. No matter who the president is, you know, it's you know, when Bush was in office, everybody wanted to blame him. Now we've got Obama in office, everybody wants to blame him. You know, so I think we need to stop with the blame game. And just start working at fixing the problem and understand that whoever is in office, hey, it's your responsibility. Let's go fix it.
Well, listen, I agree with it, but no time has any elected House voted on the same bill 40 times.
Right.
This is a little bit more than the blame game.
Right.
It's downright racist. And that's what they know. I mean, that's what it is. And you know, we can't get from that. We can't say, oh, they do it a little bit. That is a lot of crap. No time in Bush's administration did the Democratic Congress vote 40 times against one thing that he did. And they should have, because there was a lot of things that he did. But, you know, so we need to be fair on this, and that is not really fair, and that's been said a lot. But I understand where you're coming from.
There needs to be. It's just like what we were talking about when you were on the, when you were listening before about the Civilian Review Board. How the hell is this civilian when there's no independent civilians on the board? They're all picked by the daggone council.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that shouldn't be. That shouldn't be. That's exactly right. You got a Civilian Review Board. Let's let it be the civilians. Let's let it be actual laymen that are out there. And ladies and gentlemen that aren't actually elected officials that can come in here and look at this. That's exactly right.
Well, as someone who's running for president,
yes,
to fight the court, no, we now are going, I believe, that it's being talked about now and being, I think there's a suit in against that. That the FISA court was invisible. We didn't know who was on it, how many people were on it. I mean, we got a Civilian Review Board here with 11 people, and nobody knows who they are. I mean, what, are you kidding me?
Right.
That's what I asked Matt and Lee, who were on before. Is this a FISA court?
And you bring up another point, and I'm glad that you brought that up, but let me just say this now. What we really need is a president now come 2016 because of some of these things that have come up. One thing that I am going to appeal to the American people with is a president that's going to be truly transparent, and I'm going to expect every branch of government and every department to also be transparent. And here's why. You know, the scandals that we have had, if you're transparent, there's nothing to cover up. And I'm not saying that President Obama has covered it up personally, but, down throughout the different organizations, of course.
Right.
But if we've got true transparency, there's nothing to cover up because you're going to do things right. And if you're doing things right, there's not going to be a scandal.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct.
So that's one thing. And, you know, here's the thing. I will tell you this right now, Michael. I truly believe that I'm probably the most transparent candidate that you're going to ever see run for president. You know, I'm not going to sit here and tell you I'm a perfect guy. You know, I've been married twice. I've had a lot of the same struggles that many people in this country have had, of course, with my business. You know, I go through the same struggles with my small business that I'm sure that many small business owners across this country go through, feeling like the federal government is choking them out of actually having an opportunity because of the big businesses, because of the Walmarts of the world. And I like Walmart. I go to Walmart and I shop all the time. But, hey, we got to take care of the small business owners, too. But, you know, I understand that. But here's the thing. You know, I've been on top of the world, and I've been on the bottom of the world. And I'm sure that I'll be in both places again before my lifetime is up. One thing I will tell you is this. The makings of a true champion is someone that gets up one more time than he got knocked down. You see, I've been knocked down several times, but I've always gotten back up. Where else can a person, except in the United States, a person be on top of the world in his career, lose his career, get knocked all the way down into a deep hole? He can get up, dust himself off, begin again, run for president of the United States, and now pretty much every day he's on radio shows and he's going around the country. And, you know, I'm the most unlikely person to ever succeed at this, but yet here I am and we're gaining traction. And, you know, the lady that was on earlier talked about vetting the candidates way before. I've got to go, but I will say this. I'm giving you guys 3.5 years to vet me, okay? Listen, God bless you guys. May God bless the United States.
And we're going to have you on for
3.5 years.
For 3.5 years. Because,
I'll be glad to come back on. I'm a small business owner. I got to go in here and I got to work a little bit.
Well, I want you on next week if you can. So you're down at the in Fayetteville, right?
Where is that? I'm sorry?
Next week you'll be down in Fayetteville, right?
Yes, next Saturday, a week from tomorrow. I speak at 4:45 in the afternoon. That's at Freedom Park right there in Fayetteville. Anybody that wants to have a great time, there's going to be 13 different bands there from all types of genres of music. And, of course, I'll be there. And the future First Lady is going to be there. By the way, she lives down in Tampa, Florida, for all you guys that are wondering if I'm single or whatever. But, yeah, she's going to be flying up, and my team's flying in from all over the country. We've got people working in 45 states right now, including Alaska and Hawaii. One of my former football players is actually my Hawaii state coordinator. And, but we've got people all across this country working on this thing, Michael. And, people are starting to get really excited about what we've got to offer.
Well, I was very glad to meet you, and you're a breath of fresh air. And I'd like you to come back on the show. If you can call in next Friday, that's fine. It's all right, but definitely the week after.
Well, and I appreciate that. I'll come on any time that I am free, Michael. And let me go ahead and invite you and everyone else that's listening today. Please, if you want to hear a great speech about my vision for the future of this country, then please plan on being in Fayetteville, North Carolina, on Saturday, August 31st. I speak at 4:45 in the afternoon. And just come out with your family. It's going to be a great time for the family and a whole lot of fun.
All right. I'm sorry. I have another plan for that weekend, but we will get together, because I promise you that we need to get together when you get back.
Hey, before I leave, can I please give my web address, my campaign website?
Yes.
Okay, it's www.robbywells2016.com, and that's RobbyWells2016.com.
Is there a phone number they can call in?
Yeah, they can give a call at 704-618-1582.
Okay. Robbie Wells, who as presently is an independent candidate for President of the United States in 2016, but something else might be happening very shortly, and he's going to announce it on this show, I'm sure.
Hey, God
Thank
bless
you,
you guys. God bless, and God bless the United States. You guys have a great evening.
Absolutely. Thank you. You too. We have someone who's been holding for almost 7 minutes here. Let's see. I'm sorry, but you're now on the air. Who's this? Hello? Anybody there?
Happy birthday to y'all. Happy birthday to you.
Hold on.
Happy birthday, dear Dad. Happy birthday to you.
Okay, listen, you guys say that one more time, because he was opening the door for someone. Guys, one more time.
All right.
Thank you, guys.
And that's the Ooh. Choir.
The board bear.
I'm not sure about a choir. More like a key.
Thank you, guys.
That
All
was
right.
A happy
we
birthday.
Love you. Happy birthday. We'll see you soon.
Okay.
All right.
Bye.
Thank you, babe. That was my beautiful family. Thanks for calling in.
Awesome. And
but see, that's what's great about America.
Were
right
they now. A little bit off key there?
A little bit.
I thought it was the choir, the Philharmonic, but it wasn't. It was the Fortenberry Gang. That's what it was. Well, we've had a very, very nice show today.
Yes.
I mean, we learned
full
about
of fascinating
the FISA court that runs the Civilian Review Board here in Charlotte.
The non-civilian.
Oh, well,
non-civilian.
FISA Civilian Review
Board. Yes. I think we had more than just our usual debate on topics. We had fascinating guests all day today.
Robbie Wells, who is running as the independent candidate for President of the United States in 2016.
And we also heard quite a bit from Reverend Nantambu.
Oh, Reverend Nantambu.
He was
very
interesting on the whole 50th anniversary. Talked to Martin Luther King.
And, again, as usual, we didn't get to a lot of the things we wanted to talk about.
Of course. You know what? We always have too much going on. If people in the world would just slow down.
Yeah, slow down.
Things would stop happening.
Absolutely.
We would be able to get to half the topics that we have.
Absolutely. But, hey, you people out there in North Carolina, who made it possible for that moron to be the governor of this state.
Right.
You all need to get out and vote and get this man out of here.
Exactly.
I mean, because it's your responsibility why he is there. Don't tell you about this redistricting. There was how many million more? Was it 18 million? No, goodbye. It was 5 million more votes. Mm-hmm. Was it 5 million?
I think it's
four and a half million. That this governor shouldn't have got.
Well, look, due to redistricting, the truth is, in our state,
but still
now,
more Democrats voted in the state.
No, we did vote more, but the truth is now we have to vote literally 5-1 to count because of redistricting.
That's right.
So,
and we have
it is absolutely vital, though, to get people to turn out. And I mean, you got to think, look, listen, dude, let's be dire for a minute now. If you don't vote and you don't do your part, things can go downhill. And quite rapidly.
And they've gone.
You know, in democracies, things like, you know, have fallen apart, like Egypt is currently.
Well, this is
about. In democracies, things have fallen apart, like in Germany in wartime. They voted in Hitler. You know, these things happen.
He was a good guy.
So, but the correction is, in our country, we can correct the vote at the next election. So we can fix this problem. Now, you know, we may have ramifications for a decade or something like that, but we can't fix the entire problem. Well, we can fix. I'm optimistic, Mike. I'm optimistic, but we can fix this entire problem. But you know what? Nothing gets fixed, and everything gets worse if you don't show up to vote. That's the key.
It is completely. What's this breaking news? DA in
Oklahoma. Don't worry about that. No, that's it. Shooting, blah, blah, blah. Okay. We don't have time to get into gun violence, Mike.
Oh, gun violence. Oh,
and by
God.
The way, let me do just say this, though, the other day. Did you see that teacher talked down a gunman with 500 rounds?
Bookkeeper.
Well, a bookkeeper. But talked down. And there was
1847.
No NRA 500
rounds.
Required shooting of said suspect. She did it with logic, compassion, and human interaction. And that's what we need more of in this country, instead of everybody standing behind walls with guns. Okay?
And as if I can find
I mean, we don't need to arm every classroom. We need to,
with strategic,
you know,
with strategic logic. And as just like in the canyon. And what she did was, she says, don't listen to those people, listen to me. I love you. And everybody goes through these problems at one time in their life, and you are just going through one of yours. And because you had that AK-47 with 500 rounds of ammunition that can shoot everybody in this school, and you're not going to do it, and because you don't want to do it, you just need somebody to love you, and I love you.
That was it.
But did you hear what happened when he was laying down on the ground? And he said, tell the police I have a cell phone. She says, he has a cell phone. That's all he's got. So don't worry about it. Lay your hands behind you. When they came in, they said, put your hands up behind you.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like there was a gang war going in
there. Yeah, it's an escalation.
You don't see that on TV.
Look, well, this is why. Now, this is obviously that. But there has been a militarization of the police in America. And things like that. And I think that needs to stop, too.
Yeah, yeah,
but,
just ask, what's her name, in New York City. I mean, they told the CIA that they didn't need anybody to help them because we got better stuff than you.
Yeah. But, you know, this is why we have in the news. Like, just the other day, there was in the news about the little the kid with Down syndrome.
Right.
That got killed
right
by the police because the didn't understand the command when it came in. He was asking for change or something.
Right.
And then the store owner said,
change? He's got a gun.
Yeah, and then they came in and they were ordering him to get down, all of the stuff, and they all jumped on him and collapsed him to the ground because he wouldn't go down quick enough because, you know, he has Down syndrome and he didn't understand what was happening. But they tackled him and didn't stand on him long enough that they killed him, you know. And then that, you know, it's like, oh, whoops. But that overreaction stuff needs to stop. I mean, escalation doesn't help.
I mean,
and this is my problem with the NRA. The whole thing is, she was so calm, she just de-escalated the entire situation. It's the same thing a good teacher would do in a classroom when, you know, kids fighting and this man, the other, and he touched me, he did that. There's one reaction, they start screaming at all the children and slap them upside the head and see how that works. Or the other action is to, like, calm the children down and talk through the situation and end it. And that's what she did. And the opposite of that would be, what if every teacher and every custodian without a gun and started shooting at the guy with 500 rounds? How would that go?
And then,
you know what I mean? I mean, you're talking about a disaster.
And then when one custodian shot the bookkeeper because, you know, he was having an affair with her and she was going to tell his husband, so he shot her in the melee.
Yeah.
Oh, dude, that was, accidentally, the gun went off.
Yeah, and then when the teacher goes down and the kid wanted to help out and picks up the gun,
right,
and started
telling
me that it pushed him at recess.
This is the most moronic thing I've ever heard in my entire life. The most moronic thing I've ever heard. These people always have to have some excuse. Always have to have some excuse. And
I like how their answer is always the same, though, no matter what happens. More guns. That's the answer.
How come we haven't heard anything from Mr. King Wayne LaPierre?
Yeah, isn't it ironic?
Isn't it ironic that we haven't heard anything from Fox News? I mean, I don't understand it. This guy Henry, who used to be on MSNBC, Bob Henry. Was he MSNBC or CBS? Not CBS, or CNN. Yeah, CNN, probably. He's now going on the deep side of Fox News. He's like, he almost did a transverse Two-Face.
Yeah.
He's now become Two-Face. The questions he asks are so misleading and so nonsensical. That's because he now works for Fox News. And, I didn't get a chance to Mr. Mitchell, and I will see if he called me in. But we're on the air, we cannot do anything. And let's see if there's because I really wanted to hear from him, and he did call in, and we will see. I will speak to him after the show. So I'm sure he sends his apologies. And
let's
talk about your birthday now. So you had a good talk.
Yeah, speaking of closing in on the 50th anniversary.
So you had a good talk with Methuselah?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And back in the day when that's right. You were there when the dinosaurs were walking around, too.
That's
how did you kill one of those Tyrannosaurus Rex?
Well, back in those days, you actually had to take a flea stack and wedge it in the mouth.
A flea stack?
That'd be a Land of the Lost reference there for you nerds out there. But that's okay.
I see.
That's okay.
I never was a Land of the Lost person, too. a flea stack. Well, I got to see that film.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll...
Don't watch the film. Please, just watch the original really bad TV show. Even it was
better. I watched a long time ago.
Yes.
Okay.
That's even better than
the
film.
That's better than the film?
Film not worth seeing.
Because they were really lost, right? They just had their minds transfixed. Birthday. How many times do you have a birthday a year? Three or four?
I wish it seems that way. Unfortunately, it does get quicker every year. I don't know what
it's
that's 7
about. Years for every that's year.
Like,
is that what it is?
Yeah, like dog years?
Like dog years.
Oh.
Yes, it's like dog years.
Yeah, well, I am a werewolf, so that, I guess that would apply.
So now what you need to do, you need to spend your birthday catching up on the bridge.
On the bridge?
The bridge.
I don't know.
That's a great story on FX.
Well, let me say this for a second.
Yes.
Since you touched on TV, I want to mention something that I know nothing about, but I'll just say this statement.
Say it anyway.
I watch.
You watch?
Because I like especially shows that are based on books. You know, I love to read.
Oh,
right?
We have to say our severe regrets because our main man died. Gee, name just went right on my head. Yeah, you know, the TV show. Gee, I must be getting senile. I can't remember his name. oh,
well,
Alzheimer's. It's getting to me. It's getting to me.
But I just wanted to say, now, this is very serious.
Yes.
I regretted this greatly. But the end of last week, I was kind of shocked. Now, see, I like shows that are based on TV, books, because anything, a TV or a movie by itself, they're kind of weak. And I like the books behind things because they're always more.
Elmore Leonard.
We'll talk about Elmore in a minute.
Yes.
Now, Elmore is a great guy.
Yes.
This is something for TV only that just really shocked me. I watched Rizzoli and Oz.
Oh, great.
Right?
Great.
Right.
Stuff.
So Garrison writes this series, been around for a long time, but the show is actually good. I urge people to read the books. They're much better. But anyway, so the show is really well done, though. I like the show. It's got just the right mix of humor and mystery, action, everything. But last week, the young guy that plays Detective
Lee
Carl,
Thompson, something.
Apparently, from what I've seen in news items, committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy's in his 20s. Mm-hmm. And I do not understand why. And so I just urge people,
And they did not know, see anything
well,
like that.
Like
we had
45 years old.
Yeah.
Okay. Everything bad and horrific and terrible that happened to me in my teens, in my 20s, in my 30s, is completely pointless. Now, it's you get over it. You get by things. And I would urge people, there is nothing ever in your life, nobody leaving you, no job you lost, no amount of money you lost, no debt you owe, you stubbed your toe 14 times, you burned your hand with coffee. There's nothing bad enough to go and take your life.
No.
That is the old joke is the permanent solution to a temporary problem, but it's true. So I was shocked by that. I don't know what happened. I don't know anything about the story. I'm talking in the dark. But just the news alone, a 20-something-year-old guy who is on a successful hit TV show who kills himself, it's mind-boggling to me. And I don't know why you would waste your whole life, because you know what came after all of that time in my life? I've got beautiful children. I've got a beautiful life. I get to meet people like Mike Lawson and sit here on the radio and talk about things. And I would urge people to, take a breath, sit down, drink a strong shot of bourbon, or do whatever you need to do to get by, and then wait and see what next year brings, because it's better,
Yes, and I haven't seen – I'm two shows behind, so I haven't seen the one yet where they – I know they give a little thing at the end of one of the shows, so it must be the next show I haven't seen. But it's a major shock. He was a great part of that show. He added a lot of seriousness. He was the one that was serious. Him and the older guy was serious too.
He was kind of, because the brother plays kind of almost the humor,
right?
The foil over there. So he was kind of the serious side.
Right. Rizzoli and Isles go back and forth between dramatic and humor.
Yeah.
But the older guy and him were the straight people.
Yeah. So you got just a few seconds here. You want to talk, say a moment about, now we did
Elmore Leonard.
Elmore Leonard passed away.
Justified.
Fantastic author.
Justified.
Most recently, success with Justified, which is based on just originally a little short story.
Right.
Anyway, great rendition of it. But people forget, this is a guy who's, he's done quite a bit.
Oh, please.
Now, he's been writing for
We have 90 seconds.
That's
and
true.
We got here. So,
well, I would urge people, go back and watch some of these old ones. Watch Valdez is Coming. Watch Mr. Majestic.
Yep.
Watch some of these old things. Hombre. These are great shows.
Hombre?
Yep.
He did Hombre? Man.
He wrote the original.
Great.
Get Shorty. Freaky Deaky.
Right.
Killshot.
Right, right.
I mean, there's so many things.
Great part. What I got? A minute and 10 seconds. Hombre. He's going to meet the guy. Get back up the hill. And he says, he wants a palaver. Say, how are you going to make a deal? Get out of here. And Richard Boone plays a bad guy. Richard Boone says, you're not going to listen to me? You're not going to make the deal? He says, no. And then Paul Newman says to him, well, there's one thing. He said, how are you going to get back down the hill? Bam.
Yep. And that's it. The end of the show.
End
Good
of
night.
The show. Okay, everybody. We will see you next week. Tony, hit it.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started to hum. Still, it's a real good bet, the best is yet to come. The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? You think you've seen the sun, but you ain't seen it shine. Wait till the warm-up's underway. Wait till our lips have met. Wait till you see that sunshine day. You ain't seen nothing yet. The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? The best is yet to come. Come the day you're mine. Come the day you're mine. I'm gonna teach you to fly. We've only tasted the wine. We're gonna drain the cup dry. Wait till your charms are ripe for these arms to surround. You think you've flown before, but you ain't left the ground. Wait till you're locked in my embrace. Wait till I draw you near. Wait till you see that sunshine place. Nothing like it here. The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? The best is yet to come. Come the day you're mine. Oh, out of a tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came